kids, it's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everyone? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Really, really cool show lined up today, and I'm kicking things off with my good friend Royal Sefton joining. How are you doing, sir?
Doing better. I actually was pretty sick yesterday, so I've got the color back in my cheeks after a nice big bowl of ramen, some games. I'm good.
Ramen doesn't sound like a healthy kind of food to make you feel better.
It's probably not, but it was actually pretty decent ramen. I mean, it had chicken in it. It's not terrible.
It's like chicken noodle soup.
Yeah.
Chicken noodle ramen with 4,000 times the sodium.
It was a little salty. Maybe that's what put the color in my cheeks.
Possibly, but as I'm sure people have heard by the additional voice chiming in, we are joined by two guests at this time from Metanet Software. Reagan Burns, Mayor Shepard, welcome back to the show. How are you two doing today?
Hi.
Thanks. Good. Not sick.
No. Nope.
Neither of us.
Yay.
And any good ramen stories on your end?
Actually, it reminds me that it's been like a long time since we've gotten ramen.
Yeah, there's a really good spicy chicken ramen that I love in Toronto, but I think the rest of our favorites are, of course, in Japan, and it's been a long time since we've been there.
I've never been to Japan.
You should go. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm poor.
Yeah.
Bucket
well,
list.
I mean, a lot of our friends here, you know, you can kind of maybe speak at conferences or things like that. You can kind of luck out that way if you're ever able to. Something to think about.
Yeah.
Well, if the show keeps growing, maybe one of these days I'll have a reason to head out there.
Yeah, we're definitely pretty lucky that, we can write it. Some of it off because of the business related. Like, we go to Tokyo Game Show, basically. So.
Yeah. Nice.
That is awesome. I just want to get to, like, E3 one of these years, and I'll be happy. That's my bucket list. I want to get to E3.
We were there once. We've only been... Actually, I guess Mare's been twice. I've only been once.
It's pretty cool.
It's definitely crazy. Like, definitely the scale of it is pretty intense.
So is Tokyo Game Show.
Yeah, that's true. That's even worse, but...
So we should probably mention why you're here today. The last time you were on the show, you were here to talk about your game N++ releasing on Steam. And during that interview, I believe I asked you 3 or 4 dozen times whether or not it was coming to Xbox. And it's out on Xbox, and that's what you're here to talk about today.
Yeah, it finally happened.
So I will obviously take full credit and responsibility for the Xbox version of the game. So everyone, you are welcome.
Yep.
I didn't notice a special thanks for me in the credits, but, you know, what are you going to do? I know on the inside.
Yeah, we're super stoked. It's been in the works, you know, for a little while, but there's just so much to do, and we launched the Ultimate Edition on Steam before it came out, so since we only have the one programmer and really small team, it's hard. It takes a long time, but... We are so excited it's finally out on Xbox because so many people really loved N+ on the 360, and it's like we finally brought them, you know, this even better, even more beautiful sequel, and we're just so excited, so, yeah.
It's bigger, it's better, it's prettier, the music is still fantastic, and it still kicks my ass constantly.
Nice. Good stuff, yeah. I actually hadn't even heard of N+ before. When Joe invited me to review N++, I think I've been living under a rock for a better part of a decade or so. But
it was a long time ago.
Yeah, but it, you know, I've had a chance to play N++ and it's a blast. But for like the two other people who might not be familiar with it, can you kind of give us a 10-second tour of it real quick?
Sure.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So it's like a momentum-based parkour platformer, I think is what we're calling it these days. So it's kind of like it's physics-based. It's kind of like, it feels a bit like Trials, kind of like in a platformer form, where you have a lot of inertia and momentum, and it's all about, you know, learning timing, learning the feel of controlling your ninja, and how to use different parts of the level in different ways, and it's kind of like we just set it up as, I don't know, like 100, 200 hours of like constantly increasing challenge. So it starts pretty tame. There's like a pretty hearty intro section that kind of walks you through the basics. And then we just start throwing different stuff at you again and again for like a couple thousand levels.
Yeah, because basically everything in the world will kill you in this game. So your job is to try to not die as much as possible. And we feel like it gets so tense. Like each level, even though they only take about, I don't know, 30 seconds to complete, it gets super tense by the end of it, especially in the later levels where everything kind of ramps up. But so it really feels like you've accomplished something huge when you finally beat each episode and each level. And we just love that, like, thrilling, really satisfying feeling. So that's kind of why we like playing this game and why we have spent the past decade perfecting it.
And maybe we made it sound a bit like it's like a massacre platformer, but it's not really. Like, it does kind of get lumped into games like I Want to Be the Guy or that kind of, like, you know, hard, quote-unquote hard platformers, but
right.
We think it's actually pretty different than that. Like, there's a similar, like, you die and you can instantly respawn kind of thing, but the way the level design flow, we try to make levels where it's more like a playground. There's kind of, like, open space and you can find, there's not just, like, one timing and then the other timings will all kill you, or one route and the other routes will kill you. There's kind of, like, it's usually pretty open-ended. I mean, it's diverse, like, it varies. There are a few levels where there's this very specific timing because that's what that particular level's about. But on, like, in general, we try to really be a lot more open than I think most other platformers are with the level design. And I mean, maybe it's more like it harkens back sort of more to like a Super Mario 3 Super Mario World thing, where it's like, you know, it's like there's some platforms hanging in the air and you can go under them, you can go over them, whatever. It's not like there's all these kind of saws that kind of form a tunnel and you have to thread the needle always. It's pretty loose.
Yeah, you know, it kind of caught me there because I in my last review I joked it was a massacre game, and that's actually, you're right, it's not 100% accurate to describe it that way, because, you know, you got the gradual learning curve. I wouldn't call it non-linearity, but it is open-ended in terms of how you might solve a level. Which I think is pretty slick. But, you know, the parallel for me is that the game is regarded as sort of, you know, high difficulty level or tough but fair, that sort of thing. You know, what do you think about that trend toward these sorts of games? Because, you know, one of the poster children for that is probably Dark Souls, or, you know, the recently released Cuphead's another one of those games that's real high on the difficulty level.
Yeah, I mean, I could see, like, I think you're kind of right. I mean, there's definitely overlap, and definitely, I mean, one thing is that you'll just die. Like, in N++, you'll die a lot. Hundreds or thousands of times.
Oh, yeah.
we've gotten the Dark Souls of platformers. We've also, recently, we got the Cuphead of platformers, which is even weirder. I don't know.
Or it's, is like, Cuphead the N++ of platformers?
That's what we think about, like, Dark Souls, too, kind of. I think it's good. I mean, this is actually, I kind of forgot about it, but we did an Ask Me Anything yesterday, like, to celebrate the launch on Xbox, and someone asked, like, what inspired us to make N in the first place, and it made me remember, like, one of the things, like, there were kind of two things going on with games in the early 2000s, and one was, like, casual games were like a big boom, and it was really, and so part, and we kind of wanted to push back against that because we felt like there's something kind of sneaky, you know, it's kind of like games where it's fun, like, I mean, even we enjoy that kind of like casual games where you just, you know, you're idly, it passes the time, and you know, you click and you click, and then there's sort of an explosion of fireworks and like, yay, and like, that's nice, but we kind of felt like the way that that stuff was accelerating, it was kind of growing, I mean, it just felt like it's too much extrinsic motivation. It kind of ruined the intrinsic joy of playing the game when it's just kind of constantly patting you on the head. You don't get the sense of yourself, you know, the catharsis that you feel when you overcome something, because, you know, honestly, like, when you start the level, you're like, how am I going to do this? I can't do this. And then when you do it, you're breaking through, you know, your own limitations, and that it gives you something that I don't think you get from games that don't force you against a wall like that. You know, it
challenge you.
Yeah, they challenge you.
There you go.
So I do think that, like, for sure, just like Dark Souls and Cuphead, it's very, like, it is that same sort of sense of catharsis. I mean, honestly, I feel like it's maybe a bit more Dark Souls just because, like, it just, because it's about improv more. You know, it's about learning the feel of the controls. I've only played Cuphead for a couple hours, but it seems like it's very much a shooter in that it's about, like, memorizing patterns.
Kind of like Contra, really, when it comes to the boss fights and such. You remember where to stand, where to shoot, when to shoot.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's the perfect comparison. Whereas, like, I think, like, Dark Souls, it's kind of the same thing. Like, it has this learning curve, but the learning curve is all about contextuality. You know, where should you duck behind for cover? What attack should you use now? And kind of things like that that make it a bit... maybe it's just more what we're into.
And yeah. That's something I like about N++, in that a lot of these games, these really difficult games, it looks like there's a bunch of paths that you could go to take a level, but they all end in death except for one. Where N++, there really are tons of paths that you could take through a level, and they all can kill you, but none of them are guaranteed. I mean, you will die repeatedly. nearly endlessly.
Let's be clear, yeah.
But you can beat levels pretty much any way you want.
Yeah, we really thought that was important because so many different types of people play N++. Like, we wanted to make it accessible to pretty much anybody, even if they're just starting out or whether they've been playing since the end days. Because I guess it just kind of feels like we all started somewhere. And it's a game that really rewards you for, you know, dedicating yourself to getting better at it. It's very satisfying. And we felt like the only way to do that is to support a variety of different kinds of play and speedrunners and high scorers and all different reasons that you might be playing. Because everybody has their own definition of what's fun. And
yeah, it seems more fun. It's more like play. You know, it's more like, I don't know. I think that both of us kind of find games where, you know, there's just certain types of game where it's like the level designer is just sitting next to you and hitting you with a stick when you don't do what you're supposed to do. And it just, you feel kind of like a trained dog kind of thing.
And yeah, we hate that.
Yeah, we don't find that as fun as, you know, here's a bunch of toys and see what you can come up with kind of play. So, I don't know.
And something I love is that there's so many ways to beat levels, and the fact that you have a way to watch people's replays in the game so you could see how they beat the level and what they did to achieve, you know, a score that you could never dream of. So you could just sit there and watch them. And I think I spent an hour today just watching different people's replays, and the anxiety that I would feel watching these people do these runs. And I know they complete the level because, you know, I'm watching their replay. I see them just going down, like, oh my god, they're doing, what did they do?
We check out the leaderboards too. Yeah, because it's just amazing. Like, we're pretty good, but we're nowhere near as good as the, like, the people at the top of the leaderboards. It's amazing.
Definitely.
It's really like, it's just super cool to see that. Like, stuff we had no idea. That's actually, like, you're right. It's super cool that you can, like, new players can sort of get hints by looking at the leaderboards. But then, like, at the high level, people are always, like, coming up with new routes, and then everyone copies that one and tries to optimize it until someone comes up with a new one. It's pretty fun, that aspect.
Yeah, it kind of feels in that way almost like a love letter to the speedrunning community too, because, you know, you look at especially tool-assisted speedruns, and they're always finding new ways to break through these much older games. And one of the interesting things that works well with that is how spare and, like, back to basics N++ is. Like, the visuals are very simple and everything. It's almost like it's a sort of it's a good good situation to be in for that deep state of flow, that rewarding sense of accomplishment as you work through it and the ability to concentrate on it, especially. But you have a community that can work on finding the best way through, and then somebody will come up with even yet another one.
Yeah, that definitely, like, part of the community has always been about, like, high scoring and speed running, and we really try to support that because it's super cool. And you're right, like, we did, like, the game is really designed to kind of, it's like, I guess people talk a lot about games being immersive, but they only talk about it, like, in the context of a first-person 3D kind of game where it feels like reality. But I think a lot of games, abstract games, can be just as immersive when they suck you in, you know, and you're really connecting with it in this visceral way. And to me, like, that's just as immersive as, you know, imagining I'm in that forest or whatever. I think, like, a lot of games like Rez, that they don't seem realistic, but you achieve that flow state, and you kind of, like, lose a sense of yourself a bit, and you kind of merge with the game. It's cool.
They immerse you in a way that's not like, I feel like I'm in the level exploding on these spikes. You're immersed in a way of, like, you finish playing and you wonder where the past week and a half went.
Yeah.
There you go.
Because, you know, you mentioned before that someone could spend 100, 200 hours playing this, and you mentioned thousands of levels. That's not an exaggeration. Like, have, what, 4,000 levels? Something ridiculous in this game?
Yeah, I think it's 4,340 now.
Yeah. And how? Actually, like, how?
Well, I mean, half of them are multiplayer. There's, like, about 2,000 are single player, so that's slightly more manageable. But
still,
I mean,
how? There's so much content. How?
Yeah. And I mean, even 200 hours is sort of it's a bit low, because I think right now we know of two people. I think one person is 100%ed it, and one player is almost there, and he's played for about 500 hours, I think. And he's actually, like, pretty much the second best end player in the world.
Holy,
and he's already
shit.
Yeah, he already has, like, about 1,000 hours of experience, like, on the old version. So
yeah,
wow. Definitely, like, we really designed it like that, with all, like, the gold and then the secret challenges. It's kind of like there's layers of challenge, so that once you've mastered one level, you can kind of ascend to the next one. And the upper level, like, the hardest challenges are just, like, amazingly hard, like, fantastically. There's one all gold level took us, like, an entire day to make sure it was possible, because we were playing through it sort of with save states. So we would do it in sections and make sure each thing was possible. But in the game, you have to do it for real in one run. And he actually, this player, Zella, he just recently has been speedrunning Rose, and he did this level in two. He only died once. He did it in two tries. And it's just like this.
Wow.
It's amazing. Yeah. Like, it's like it took us, like, hundreds of tries. And that was with kind of cheating and saving our progress every once in a while. So
then there's hardcore mode.
Oh yeah,
which is new for the Ultimate Edition, which it sort of makes the single player mode even harder. No, it definitely not yeah, sort yeah. of definitely
way harder.
Does. Much
how?
Harder.
How could it make it harder?
Well,
yeah. Well, like, one thing is that it's like a marathon down each column, so it's 25 levels in a set instead of 5. But the main twist is that in the normal game, when you die, your timer just resets to what it was when you first hit the level. So there's no penalty for failure normally. But right. In hardcore, the clock is always ticking. So when you die, you don't get back the time that you lost, that you spent on that failed attempt. So it's much more of a balancing act, where sometimes it's better to not even try to get the gold if it's too risky, because you'll lose more than you stand to gain. It's very interesting, and we were really excited about it, because it, like, it gives us kind of nerves. Like, we're so used to playing that the main game, only in the hardest levels do we kind of get, like, shaky hands.
Right.
But in hardcore mode, every time by the end, you're just like, it's always on a knife's edge. It's really fun.
Do you offer therapy sessions to the people who play this stuff?
No, but hilariously, I forget when it was. Like, I guess maybe around 2010, someone wrote to us, and they were, like, a doctor that worked at a clinic, and...
Yeah, they're a neuroscientist.
Oh, yeah, sorry, neuroscientist.
They were doing some experiments with aggression, I think, yeah. And like basically
people who couldn't control their anger. Yeah,
they were using N in those tests because it tends to, in some people, I guess, provoke that sort of reaction. So that was cool.
Yeah, it was like they had it set, like hooked up to a heart monitor or something that measured how stressed you were, and if they got too stressed, the game would just stop, and until they calmed down. So it was kind of helping people learn how to manage their stress and like calm themselves, which is actually the key to being good at N++. Is to not, as soon as you start getting stressed about it, you fail a lot more.
True.
And being relaxed is kind of like the secret to success. So it's kind of cool.
It's kind of like,
so what I basically heard is that Joe asked if you guys offer therapy sessions. It sounds like N++ is a therapy session in a way.
Yes.
In a way,
if
yes.
used the right way, in conjunction with a trained neurosurgeon.
The neurosurgeon contacting you to like bill you for damaged controllers he had?
I know. I think he wanted us, so we could make sort of a custom build that would work better with his, the shut-off mechanism. I forget.
And he really wanted to let us know that this was effective.
Yeah, he'd like to thank us.
Yeah.
It was cool.
Able to make a custom build for him?
I don't remember. Like, it probably wasn't that hard, because it was not, like, a big change. It was something about,
it was
like,
just N, so
yeah.
The framework was a lot simpler than it is these days.
Flash.
So what kind of differences are there from the original N to now N++ Ultimate Edition HD Remix, possibly?
Well, I mean, on like a technical level, it's rewritten entirely. So the original N was made in ActionScript and Flash.
Mm.
But now it's in C++. And so it's a lot more smooth and precise. And there are a lot of, like, that gives us some flexibility in what we can control, because you know you're limited with Flash in a lot of ways, and it also let us create a custom vector renderer, which meant that the graphics could be just as smooth as the game feels, which is great, because then you can really, like, it just feels a lot better if you go back and play N. It's more obvious, but it's hard to describe what that feeling is like.
It's definitely something we've noticed, like, everyone, if you've played N or N Plus and you play N++, it's very easy to feel like, oh yeah, I remember this. But
it's the same.
Yeah, it's because it seems the same, because you remember it as being this amazingly, wonderfully smooth game. But if you actually go and try playing them like back to back, it's surprising how bad the old ones feel in comparison. Because like, we really, like, the game itself, the basic mechanics of the game haven't changed, but we've just kind of tweaked things and tuned things and massaged things in subtle ways again and again, and until it's really weird, because even we didn't understand that was happening. We were like, oh yeah, but then we had to play N+ for some reason, I think, to test Xbox One backwards compatibility, and we're like, wow, like N++ feels way better than this. It's great to know that we actually improved. But actually, what Mare mentioned about the graphics, like, that's something really weird and subtle that I think a lot of people don't appreciate, how the graphics can be, like, the most important aspect of how a game feels, because that's where you're getting most of your feedback from. And so what the anti-aliasing is huge, because, like, without it, you can only gauge the movement of things pixel by pixel, right? Like, the smallest resolution you can work with is 1 pixel, but like, we're doing, I think, the equivalent of 256 times anti-aliasing. So, like, the smallest visual component is a 256th of a pixel, like a tiny, like, you're moving in fractions of a pixel, which is, it's like, you can't really see it, but you can absolutely feel it. And you need, like, everything is geometrically, like, infinitely mathematically precise, all the level geometry and stuff, so you can actually use that precision. It, like, the high level players definitely use it to like jump right between mines or that kind of thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, so that begs the question, when do we get the 4K version?
We're looking into it. It's because it's like, it is all vector graphics. And unfortunately, like, vector graphics are supposed to be easy to scale, but it actually our game graphics work a lot more like fonts, where in theory, you can just scale them, but it doesn't actually look as good. You kind of want to manually hint things to make it just pop to make everything massageable. So there is some work, and the menus need a lot of work too.
Yeah,
but
the UI is, I think, the most complex part of it. Yeah. Making everything look good at different resolutions.
But we definitely want to support 4K on like Steam and Xbox and PS4, because now that they can do 4K, I mean, the game is all about smoothness and, you know, fluidity, and it would just be that much better.
Would that entail a lot of work to completely redo everything for 4K?
No, it's not really redoing it. It's just more, like, I think the way, I actually don't super remember, because we didn't program it and it's been a couple years, but my recollection is the way that everything works is that we've kind of defined keyframes, like we defined values at certain points, and I think one of them is 1080p and one 720p. And so for resolutions in between that, we just kind of interpolate between those two to get the values. So we just need to go and make another set of them. So it's not like a huge amount of work, but it's also not like we can just press a button. It's, you know, it's like a few weeks, a month or two.
I thought there'd be a 4K button right next to the enable online button that everyone expects exists. Which leads to the question. I know this was brought up last time you were on. I know this was asked in the AMA. People are asking, is N++ ever going to get online play?
So we hope so.
We would love that. It's just a problem of resources. We do not have the money to do that. Yeah. So we're definitely considering a Kickstarter, but when we've consulted with network multiplayer specialists, and we've consulted with many, this consensus seems to be it's going to take 8 to 10 months and maybe a low six-figure salary. So, or not salary, but budget, I guess, because it's more than just paying them their server costs and all this other stuff too. But anyway, so that would be great, but that's a heck of a lot for Kickstarter. So if we're going to do that, we need to make sure that it's feasible, and it's a lot of work to run a Kickstarter, and we don't want to have people be disappointed. But I mean, the main thing is every time we get asked that question, lots and lots of people come forward and say, I would totally support that Kickstarter. The community's behind you, and we can do this. So although we're not sure it will work out, because that is a heck of a lot of money, we're really happy that people are so supportive of the idea. And yeah, we would love to do it, because the local multiplayer is so good. We really want more people to play.
Yeah, it's definitely frustrating, but it's just one of those things where we could certainly put in some kind of online for like on the cheap, but it would just kind of suck. And our whole thing about N++ is we're not making another one, and we want to be like built for posterity. And so we just want everything in it to be as good as we can make it. And so we don't really want to settle for inferior online. We want to be like, I mean, the people we talk to, the people like the engineers and stuff that we're looking to work with are all people that have worked on big AAA multiplayer games. So they know what they're talking about, and they can definitely execute. It's just that that's like an order of magnitude more work to do it right. And we don't know if Kickstarter doesn't exactly work. So one of our friends floated the idea of like maybe we could work with a publisher to make a special version, or like, we don't really know. We're just going to keep trying to look into it and hope that you know, a good option presents itself. And if not, you know, in the next few months, then we're not going anywhere. So one of these years, when the stars align,
It's better to make sure it's done right and not half-ass it, instead of being like, oh, well, N++, it was a great game, and then they threw in this half-assed online that just kind of ruined the experience.
Yeah. That's our thinking, definitely.
Yeah, and I haven't really had a chance yet to try the couch multiplayer, but could you give us just a quick sum of what the multiplayer game is like, what we do have?
For sure. So that's another thing that's new in N++ version, like, you know, compared to other versions of the game. N+ did have co-op and competitive multiplayer, but we sort of redesigned everything for N++. I mean, the co-op is the same, but the levels are a lot
Yeah, it wasn't really that. It was okay. It was fun, because the base game is kind of fun, but in N+, we didn't have a lot of time,
and
we had no experience, because we had never done. But now it's like sort of 10 years later, all the new enemies that we added, we were designed from the ground up like to support player interaction in multiplayer, and that just gave us a lot more tools to work with. So I don't know if you want to explain the co-op. It's basically the same as the main game. One of you has to reach the exit to win. Often the other player needs to kill themselves to make that possible, or distract enemies, or kind of like I don't think we enumerated all of the various mechanisms we learned to sort of make you cooperate or coordinate with each other, but there's definitely like a few dozen different ways in the game system that you can kind of force players to coordinate their movements. Like the most basic would be like a toggle mine, where if both players need to get to the other side of a toggle mine, the first person on it needs to stay on it so it doesn't arm itself until everyone's passed, kind of thing. And it's just like a lot of things like that where you kind of have to time things together or kind of split up strategically, or, you know, it's like, I'll take the rocket over here and keep it alive so that you can sneak in past the rocket.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Or sometimes nice. They need to jump together or...
Yeah.
It's great because then when players, you know, sit down and look at the level, they devise a strategy together and then try to execute it and see what happens. And we really love how they, you know, how this, like, really cool conversation develops about what's happening and who's going to do what, and then what happens when that doesn't work out. Like, it's just so cool to see people playing that way and working together. It's really fun.
Conversation, argument.
Well,
it's a fact.
It's your turn to be the sacrificial lamb. It's not my turn to die.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So how many friendships have your game destroyed over the years?
Too many to
Yeah, count. We prefer to think of it as friendship testing.
Yeah. Maybe it's made them stronger.
Yeah.
That's fair. Is there a competitive play mode as well?
Yeah, so there's a race mode in N++, which is competitive multiplayer, up to 4 players, and I mean, it's essentially in the name. You're running a race, you're trying to get to the exit, but the thing that we added to this we added actually a lot of things. So we tweaked the rules a bit, and we tweaked how scoring works so that, you know, it's not like the same person is going to be running away with the game all the time. There are some things that you can do that are strategic and make things more exciting. But the coolest part of race mode is that you get to turn into a rocket when you successfully get to the exit and then fly around and kill all the other people.
Yeah. Right. That's definitely the most fun.
It's just so exciting.
Like, it's the best part of the game, I think.
Yeah.
It's so good. It's so satisfying because the rocket is just as hard to control as the ninja. It has like the same kind of feeling of inertia to steer it around. So when you get good enough to like hunt people down and you can see they start to panic and they're like, oh my God. And then, oh, it's just great. And they explode into chunks and bounce around.
Yeah.
I'm guessing awesome. That's what the achievement for kill another player using rocket 5 times in single multiplayer race is for, huh?
Yeah,
that's right. Cause it's so fun.
Yeah.
Nice.
And I mean, I think you can even do that solo. If you can just sign 2 players in and then just let the second player stand at spawn while the first player's rocket goes back. And it's a good way of training.
For the people who want to cheese it and get some easy achievement points. Speaking of, you might have one of the easiest achievements I've seen in a game recently, and that is to die during the solo introduction.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's called You Suck, But That's Okay. So...
Yeah, I got that.
Thank you for that self-esteem boost.
Well, we were just trying to let you know that, you know what?
That's what the game's all about.
Yeah, you're going to die. That's all right.
Yeah.
You're just starting out.
That's how you learn. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. We were all there.
Did you get using your head?
Yes. Yes, I did.
another favorite.
That was a fun shock to discover.
Yeah.
Oh, physics matter going up too. Okay. Yeah. Now I know. And our ninja does not wear a helmet. No. I want to ask you about the music, because that was one of the things that really caught me. I'm a big fan of a lot of different electronic music. How did you guys decide on the soundtrack and put it together? Because it's interesting. It has sort of like an alien coldness to it because it's largely, you know, techno and electronic and IDM type stuff. So it's not real tuneful, but it fits perfectly.
Thanks.
What was the process for that?
We're super happy with how the soundtrack came out. We didn't, like, honestly... I think for the first year of development, we were like, against any music.
Like, this is never going to work.
Yeah, yeah, because we were like, the game is all about minimalism, so it doesn't need music and whatever. But then eventually, I mean, we're big fans of electronic music too, and we just sort of, once we started playing around with color and the game got a lot more diverse and interesting, we started thinking about, like, okay, maybe we could find something that would work. And honestly, it was just this, it was like the most fun part of the development for me, I think, because it's kind of like in evenings, weekends, whenever we just had, like, you know, an hour or whatever, we would trawl through SoundCloud and Bandcamp and sometimes YouTube and just kind of randomly look for stuff, find labels. Definitely the main thing was, like, if you find a label whose aesthetic you think really works, and then you can just check out all their artists and kind of mine them, find sister labels, find just that sort of, like, basically we were just, I hadn't really been keeping up with electronic music since, like, the early 2000s, so there's a lot of stuff, a lot of, like, discovering of stuff that was super fun.
Yeah. So,
like, essentially we'd both do that, and we assembled, you know, like, a few hundred songs we thought might work. And then what we did was we played the game while listening to them. And that was like surprising, because you'd hear a song and it would kind of have this vibe. Like, you're right, we definitely were going for a kind of like an abstractly sci-fi, a bit menacing, a bit of tension kind of mood, with, like, there's some, like, happy songs and some more ambient down. Like, we tried to do some dynamics and arrange, but in general, like, there's the kind of this, we wanted to create this kind of techno-futuristic vibe. And so we had all these songs we thought fit, but when we started playing the game while listening to these things, we realized some of them it was crazy how poorly some of them worked. Not because they were bad songs, but because they didn't cooperate with the game. Like,
right.
Some of the songs were just too ambient that it sucked all of the tension out of the game, and it made the game feel way more boring than it was. And then on the other end, some of the songs were so intense that the game became almost unplayable, because it's like, it's already kind of nervy, you know, you're kind of on edge sometimes when you're playing it, you get anxious. If you have a song that's kind of like pounding you and making you even more anxious, it's kind of unbearable. It just stops being fun. Like, in both cases, it kind of ruined the fun. So, which was like, we had never anticipated anything like that. It was kind of a real eye-opener. So we kind of vetted all the songs by, like, when you play it, does it kind of stick in your brainstem in the right way? And does it, you know?
Yeah, like, it's in the background, but it's still helping you, you know, like, it's providing something while you play. It's not just, it's not throwing you off, but it's not, like, not adding to the experience either.
It's
like a weird thing to talk about.
Atmosphere and mood. It is, I think we don't have great words. It's a bit subtle.
But, yeah, neurosurgeon have his... his patients test out the music as well to see if it works.
That would have been funny. We should get in touch.
So anyways, we just had like a bunch. I think at that point there was like maybe about 100 songs. And then it was just like several months of emails and contracts and wire transfers. And luckily we had some help, like one of our friends in Toronto and also the developer behind, what's it called?
Lattle Planet X.
No, Lattle Planet X is a Toronto guy. Ollie Ollie. The developer behind Ollie Ollie, like, it had a licensed soundtrack, and we really liked it. So we asked them, hey, how do you license music? Because we didn't know anything.
Yeah.
And they, like, totally broke it down. They explained all these terms, the sort of contract you need, and that sort of thing, and how to contact people. And so, they helped us so much. And, I mean, it was still a lot of work, but, like, it was just so smooth because we had all this knowledge that they had given us. So it was just like, we found like 40 or so labels that wanted to work with us, and it found, you know, like it was really cool to work with other small, you know, teams of like one or two people, creative people, and that, you know, wanted to be part of it. It was really cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I love the Roll 7 guys too. They're awesome.
Yeah. Definitely, yeah. And Ollie Ollie is a fantastic parallel to that, I think, except more, you know, turntablism and other stuff and that soundtrack niche. But yeah, definitely a very fitting sound. Taking away the soundtrack, the sounds themselves were impressive because they're real crunchy. It's like sort of a darkly satisfying thing, hearing yourself get crushed or smashed or blown up. Who did the sound design?
Michael Surix.
Yes.
I kind of... forget how you pronounce his last name.
I think that's right.
Yeah, it's like it's CSC something or anyways.
Welcome to every week of my show when I have guests on.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, actually, that was something where we totally agree at the sound. We were super happy with how it came out. About the ragdolls, there were definitely like several passes of where, and, like, we've experienced this with every version of the game where our feedback was like, it needs to be, we need more bone crunching.
Yeah.
And
can it be a little wetter?
Yeah, and also wetter. Like, there needs to be a wet, meaty thwacking sound.
Yeah.
Because that's something that we found, like, the game, the graphics are so abstract that if you have a very visceral sound design, it really helps. You just feel the impact so much more. sorry, Michael's company is called Bright Skull.
Yeah, they were great.
They did the sound. And, I mean, when we were doing pre-production, we had narrowed it down to two teams. The other one, oh my god, I forget. It's like they're indie music guys from Vancouver, and they do everything. Oh my god, I can't believe I forget their...
Power Up Audio.
Yeah. That's it. Like, yeah, basically, half of indie games that have come out have been done by Power Up Audio, and they're really amazing. And Kevin Regamey, who works there, was a big N fan, but... we ended up going with Michael purely because he made this demo reel where he took footage of the original N and overlaid his own sounds. And the one specific sound that never changed, like the reason why we went with like this, let's go with him, was the Gauss turret, that sniper that kind of tracks you and then it shoots. That kind of like really anxiety inducing high pitched crackly homing sound in this shot that sounds like so powerful. That was in that video, and for both of us, we're like, oh my god, like, we really responded to that. It just, yeah. It was perfect. So, that's kind of, like, what made us decide, and, yeah, we totally agreed that he knocked it out of the park. It was really awesome working with him.
Yeah, you made an excellent choice there. My daughter, she's six, and she's a huge Geometry Dash nut, the tap and jump game. But she took to N++ pretty well and started outdoing me on some levels, which impressed the crap out of me. But when that Gauss turret came into it, she can't play anymore. She cannot keep it straight because it scares her so much. The sound is just so active. I mean, you guys really create a good mood with that. So kudos there. That was awesome.
Have you ever made a six-year-old say, fuck this game?
She did not say that.
In front of you.
She did not say that. I promise. Well, what kind of games do you guys have. Sorry. Yes. Like I said before, you know, what I do is my Peter Boyle impression as much as I can, so I don't teach them any new words. You know, instead just kind of make those loud, like young Frankenstein grunts of frustration if I die and die again. Nice. But what kind of games do you guys enjoy playing, out of curiosity?
Lots of different games.
I think it's like pretty diverse. We just started Zelda a couple days ago.
Yeah, like 2 days ago.
Breath of the Wild, or whatever it's called.
Of course, nice. It's awesome. Everybody already knows that, but we are just...
We were working on N++ when it came out, so we didn't really have time.
Because we knew that once we started it, that would be it for the rest of our free time. So that's where we're at now.
I just started playing an idle game called, I think it's Universal Paperclips by Frank Lance, who's like from NYU. Like, I think is the head of the games division. It's very interesting. Definitely, we've played a few idle games, but this is the only one that I've actually like have stuck with. And I mean, what else have we been playing? I still play Battlefield 4 pretty regularly. I find that it's like an incredibly fun multiplayer game. I think it's like we're super diverse. Yeah. Super Mario World.
Oh yeah,
because we got a Super Nintendo Mini, so
we were very lucky.
Yeah. Nice. I got mine too.
Nice.
What was the first game you played on it?
I guess actually it might have been Final Fantasy III.
Yeah, I mean we definitely haven't played far. We started it. But for only about 5 minutes.
And then we're like, oh yeah, every game back then started with like half hour cutscene.
I think my first one was Earthbound because I love my Earthbound.
Oh nice.
It's so good. Yes.
We still haven't finished Mother 3, so we're kind of like, we don't want to play Earthbound. We want to play Mother, like finish that first because we've already, like, I guess
I think we've started it twice at this point.
Yeah, we keep starting Mother 3 and then like work stuff comes up and we drop it. And
I'm still holding out hope that Nintendo's going to bring Mother 3 to America.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard like I've heard that it's never going to happen because some of the music is kind of license infringy, or it's something about licensing. They can't license the music in North America for some reason. So
yeah, I thought I'd heard something about that. Maybe it was a sample source or something, because I think they said Beatles and something there.
I know they said the same thing with Earthbound, but Earthbound has been re-released. If you listen to the Skyrunner music in Earthbound, it is straight up The Who.
Yeah.
Won't get fooled again. The organ in there, it is The Who. There's no other way around it. The one Dungeon Man music is, what is it? The Beatles. What song? Shit. Sergeant Pepper Reprise, I think.
Yeah.
Oh.
So I know there's questionable music and samples in Earthbound, but I guess it wasn't bad enough that they were still able to re-release it on the Virtual Console and then on the 3DS Virtual Console and now on the SNES Classic. Thank God. So I'm still hoping one of these days we'll see it. I have the import cartridge sitting on my shelf, and I guess that gives me fair license to play the translated version. I would rather just play it officially instead of a fan translation. So
yeah,
for sure.
It is a bit frustrating.
Emulating it just doesn't have the same feel as popping it into a Game Boy.
Yeah, emulating it, actually, we've never found it that it works because the timing is way off. Like, because you have to, it's like, it's got like the active, like, you have to tap on the beat to do extra damage kind of
like
thing.
Like a rhythm battle.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And actually, we haven't found an emulator where that works. But what we did find was that you just use the Game Boy, Super Game Boy, whatever it's called.
The GameCube?
Yeah, the GameCube, like the thing that lets you play Game Boy Advance games on your GameCube.
Mm.
Then you can play it on your TV, which I think is like nicer for RPGs. But
so the way when I dabbled with Mother 3, there was some kind of like built-in action replay or Game Shark, whatever, so that every time you hit the button, it counted as a proper attack.
Oh, cool.
So it's the cheesy way to do it, but it's probably one of the only easy ways to get through the battle system.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference too.
Just Nintendo, get your shit together.
Please.
Yeah. Oh man, so many games that Nintendo just needs to get it together. So you mentioned that you're playing Breath of the Wild on the Switch, N++ on the Switch. Is that going to be happening?
Wouldn't that be so great? It would be, because we already know that from the N+ days that, even though we weren't maybe 100% happy with N+ on DS and PSP because of some, you know,
didn't feel right.
Yeah, it didn't quite feel right. But playing it on the go was amazing. And that's why we wanted to do that in the first place, because it's like the perfect bite-sized gameplay, like pick it up while you're on the bus and then, you know, stop when you have to get off the bus, whatever.
Miss your stop because you're trying to beat that one level.
Exactly. Yeah. It's so good. So yeah, we would love to.
We're working on it.
We're trying to make it happen.
Yeah, and also, seeing this is a little fringe, maybe, but is there a Linux port coming for N++?
Yeah, there is. It kept, like, unfortunately, it just keeps getting bumped by other higher priority, like the Xbox port, and now we're porting Ultimate Edition to PS4. But once that's done, then we will get to Linux. We feel really bad. It's just like, the reality is we need to keep doing things to generate money to pay programmers to do the next thing.
Right.
So of necessity, Linux gets bumped.
We want to support it. That's definitely happening. It's just that it's not going to pay a whole lot.
Yeah, and we just don't have enough bandwidth to like hire someone on top of the people that we're already working with. So we have to wait till whatever they're working on is done before they can work on more stuff.
Yeah,
that's kind of a can of worms, I guess, to open once in a while, because, you know, there's a small but very vocal community of Linux and GNU players out there.
Absolutely,
so.
And we totally respect that, and that's why we want to bring N++ to Linux, because, like, for a while, people weren't bringing their games to Mac, even, because the community was so small, but,
right.
You know, they're still important, and they're still awesome, and basically, we just want more people to be playing N++, so as many times as we can port, we're gonna.
Yeah.
Cool.
Are there any platforms that it just wouldn't really work on? Like, it's on PS4, it's on PC, it's now on Xbox One, you're bringing it to Linux, you're eyeing up the Switch. Where does it stop?
Well, I mean, for one thing, we
never.
Can't...
Never. It's everywhere.
Mobile. We can't do
Virtual
mobile.
Boy.
Fridge. N++ fridge next year.
You're going to take the throne from Skyrim for most versions.
I don't know. Like, yeah, we... I mean, we definitely would like to keep porting it as new consoles come out. And, but, I mean... Are there going to be new consoles? I remember when this generation came out, there were a lot of think pieces about, like, if, you know, is there going to be another generation?
Right,
so
that's
I guess
true.
We'll have to see. We definitely aren't going to do a phone version. Everyone already always asks, like, when are you going to make an iOS version? But it's like, games like this just need buttons. That's just how it does not feel right. You need that tactile, immediate precision,
because you don't want to think, did I press that button, did I jump, did I,
yeah,
you can't think, there's no time,
it doesn't work.
You got to make that N++ auto runner.
Yeah, well, like Meat Boy is doing that, so we'll just whenever Meat Boy Forever comes out, we'll kind of borrow their things and kind of turn it around on them.
It's a great idea.
Well, so besides porting N++, what do you guys have in the future? Something with Office Yetis?
Yep.
I definitely want to return to Office Yeti. I think that would be hilarious. But I think, like, in the near future, obviously we still have some more N++ work to do, but we kind of just want to play around with... We have a ton of really small, maybe interesting, but who knows, ideas that we need to play with a bit and see where they go. And I think... Because when we made N, it was cobbled together from a lot of these small experiments, and we didn't have a plan for N, like what N would become when we first started making it.
We kind of just went with the flow, and yeah, it kind of evolved organically. Yeah.
I think we want to try that again, like just make some small, you know, parts of things and see if we can fit them together into a way that makes sense and feels good. So we sort of don't know what's going to happen next, no. But like we have lots of ideas and we'll definitely make more games. We have so many more games we really want to play that don't exist. So we'll work on it, but I don't know exactly what's going to be next.
I'm guessing you just want to take a break from N at this point in time.
Yeah, it's kind of been winding down. Like I think once we release Ultimate Edition, because we were, you know, making levels for that.
There's a lot
through 2016. So like we once that came out earlier this year, we did feel like we were more mostly done. It will be nice to have it all like fully complete, but I think we're already kind of feeling a bit of like, it's finally, you know,
yeah, like we did it. All right.
Especially now that we launched on Xbox, that was kind of like the last big thing. Cause we know like we do have a big community of fans of N+, and We did really want to, like, it was really cool. Like, I think we got a lot of good feedback when we launched on Steam, but it was really awesome to see so much positivity from the Xbox community, people that just really liked N+. It was nice to finally be able to give them something new and fun and exciting.
Yeah.
So reception's been good so far?
Yeah.
Yeah, great. I mean, hopefully... Lots of people play it. We don't know what any kind of sales numbers or anything are yet, but
yeah,
it doesn't really matter. So far, it's been amazing, and we're just like amazed that, you know, the Reddit community was super positive. We've gotten a lot of emails and tweets and things like that saying that people are really enjoying it, and like that's why we do what we do, really.
Yeah. That and, like, the YouTube videos of people screaming at each other and laughing.
Well, yeah.
This no, fucking game, that. I'm fucking trying to son of a bitch!
Yeah. Honestly, the
thumbs up.
Co-op Let's Plays are really fun to watch, because it's like, it's, you know, it's like the dramatic moments where it all hinges on this one person, and then they just totally fail, and then... Or, one of the funniest things is, in co-op, you can kill the other player if you're already dead, because sometimes the level's impossible. So, it's like, because we noticed when we were playtesting, half the time you're playing co-op, you're like, kill yourself, kill yourself. Because if you die, the level's impossible, so the other person has to die. So we just made it a button. But we didn't really anticipate the hilarious trolls you could use, like in co-op, where one player's like gliding in the air about to hit the exit, and then they blow up for no reason because the other player suicided them. Hilarious.
That's fantastic. You need to, for a new trailer for the game, you need to get in touch with these streamers and ask for their permission to use footage of just like a minute long commercial of people cursing at each other or just sitting there with like their hands in their heads like, that's the trailer I want to see next.
We definitely have a couple good clips that we've saved. One was like an awesome because it wasn't negative. It was like just this one guy. It was like four people playing co-op, and this one guy just heroed this. Like made it was not supposed to be beatable by one person, but the other three people's deaths took out enough mines that it was like technically possible. But he had to pull off this crazy jump, and then he did it. And it's like their mic just got so distorted because they were all screaming and like dancing in the air.
Oh my god! Oh my god!
Awesome.
It was really cool.
It's brilliant.
Now I want to find this video.
Yeah, I know where I'm going after this.
Yeah, I know. Last time you were on, you were telling me about the one custom stage of like the guy. You just start the stage, and it pretty much plays by itself to the point where you're chasing a missile. And I saw that brought up on Reddit as well. I'm just like, hey, yes. It's that stage you were telling me about.
That it was exactly that stage. Good memory. Yeah, it's amazing. Those don't do anything levels. Really cool.
How many created stages are in the game at this point?
They're about, by players, they're about 30,000 levels across all platforms. And so no matter what game or what platform you're playing on, you get to play all those levels, which is, we think, pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty nice, because I know some companies are more dickish with cross-platform stuff than others. Not going to name Sony's name here, but I'm glad that I know Infinite Mini Golf has the same thing where if a level's created on one platform, it's available for everyone. So I'm glad to see stuff like that available so that thousands of stages. If the 4,000 built in isn't enough for you,
yeah,
30,000 more 30, are out 000. There just yeah, waiting to 29,000
of those are harder than the built in ones.
Are there,
like, the community is really awesome. They do contests and like level
like themes.
Theme
contests. Yeah, it's really cool.
And sometimes, because we mentioned there are a whole bunch of secrets in the game, sometimes they make their own secret challenges. Like the goal of, like, the primary goal of the level isn't really just to beat it. It's to do whatever the secret challenge is. And it's just so cool to see them taking things in their own direction and doing things that we would never do, but are so awesome.
Yeah, a lot of stuff we didn't think of.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Like what?
Just uses of enemies or like weird specific jumps.
Yeah, they get very creative with jumps.
Like very weird stuff we didn't really know is possible with the physics of the game. Like, you know, those bouncy bounce blocks, the, like the platforms that kind of are springy.
Mm-hmm.
You can jump up through, like you can, if you jump, like if there's one above you and you jump up into it kind of, and you graze one of the bottom corners, you can then jump again.
You get like a boost.
Yeah.
Essentially.
It's really hard to pull off, but you can do some really weird stuff. So there are a few levels where you have to do that to beat the level.
Oh god.
And it's quite a puzzle. But luckily you can just watch replays. Yeah. I mean, they don't super help because it's still super hard to pull off, but they at least let you know that it's technically possible.
Right.
So that's something.
Oh my god. Do you have any absolute favorites that are user created stages right now, besides the one you mentioned last time?
No, I can't remember the names.
There's a whole section of levels that are featured in N++, and they're community submissions. We curated a couple of them, like a bunch of them too, but lately the community has been selecting their favorite levels, which we feature, and they're all like, I don't know, they're all amazing for a variety of reasons. Some of them look really incredible, some of them have like really cool tricks that you need to pull off, but they're all like awesome. Mm-hmm. So there's a tab, if you go to browse, you can go to featured and see, I don't even know how many are in there right now.
No, I have no idea.
A couple hundred maybe. Yeah. They're all so good.
It's not a specific level, but one thing I really like is some of the like more prolific map makers have little signatures that they put into their levels, like a little design made out of tiles or mines or something that's like their initial or their name kind of thing. I thought that was super cool.
It's awesome.
It's like a really fun trend, I think. Like it's just a fun, like, you know, it's just like you can do it, and just thinking of doing that and then you know, making that a thing, it's fun. It kind of adds a cool dimension to it, I think.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So many creative people out there, and I'm not one of them.
Oh, that's good. You can enjoy the tens of thousands of levels.
Yeah.
You know, just in case you've already beat the 4,000 in the game and you're just getting bored with it, obviously.
Yeah, only a few hundred hours, a few thousand hours in. What's a few more? You know?
Seriously.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, Mayor Reagan, it's been fantastic having you back on the show. Was there anything that you wanted to talk about with the game that we didn't bring up?
I don't think so. I think that's about it. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing's springing to mind. It's out on Xbox One. Buy it.
Also PS4. Yeah,
and PS4 and Steam.
And where can people keep up to date with you guys and what you're doing and whatever you're going to be working on next, you know, N++++?
I mean, probably we're definitely not making N++++.
Nope, this is it.
Oh, N-sharp.
N-sharp.
N-infinity.
Oh, there you go. You have the
name.
When
we were trying to come up with N++, we went through every symbol in the book.
Because, let's be honest, N++ is not the greatest name. Nobody knows that it's, like, a completely new game.
Yeah, a lot of people read it as N+ still. It's a bit confusing.
But it is totally new.
Anyways, I think...
bitch to find in stores.
Yeah, there's
that's super frustrating.
It's getting better.
But... it's weird. On the 360, we didn't have this problem. As soon as you hit N, as soon as you punch in the letter N, N+ was the first result. So I don't know what they did with their search algorithms, but...
if you use Google, though, that'll get you there.
Google works.
Google knows everything.
I guess on Twitter is probably the best thing.
Or metanetsoftware.com/blog.
Yeah, that's good, too.
Sounds good. Well, again, thank you both so much for coming on the show. It is always a pleasure having you back on. Come back again soon. It's great having you two on.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. It was awesome.
Thank you.
Do you have any final words to end the interview?
Oh, no.
No,
putting you on the spot.
God.
Oh, my God.
Be awesome.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for sticking around. I hope you enjoyed the interview, but now we have some business to take care of. We got some reviews we got to get through. We're kicking things off with Chris Taylor. How are you doing tonight, sir?
I am doing good. I totally got owned at a Katamari tournament today.
I thought you were, like, practicing and ready.
Yeah, they wound up going with the one stage I didn't practice, that damn crab stage.
Oh, you scrub.
Yeah, I know. I did not. I could only collect 112 water bugs, and that was not enough.
How could you? You've let us down.
I have. It's because I was too busy playing these games that I'm going to talk about today.
Yeah, you've got some RPG goodness to talk about, so let's get into things. Yeah. The first game you're here to talk about is called Mary Skelter Nightmares, developed by Idea Factory and Compile Heart, published by Idea Factory International, released September 19th on the PlayStation Vita for $39.99. Escape the living jail before Nightmare consumes you in this DRPG. Join the Maidens to use class systems and transformations in turn battle, but beware. Turn-based battle, but beware. Challenging nightmares can chase you down and keep you imprisoned forever. Chris, what is Mary Skelter Nightmares?
It's that. No, I'm just kidding. I always feel like the summary takes, like, I was like, oh, I was going to say that. And I was like, well, that's not a very good review, is it? If I just describe what the game is.
Pretty much.
Mary Skelter Nightmares. So this is a Vita game that actually, it should be stylistically something that someone would expect to see on the Vita and nothing else. That is to say, it's really stylized anime. I would maybe say a gothic science fantasy hybrid kind of thing. Basically Etrian Odyssey by way of early 2000s Hot Topic. That would be the best way to put it. So DRPG, I was hoping that meant dungeon crawling RPG, and I was not mistaken. I was not disappointed.
Yeah, that was my guess as well.
Yeah, this is a first person dungeon crawling RPG, like, you know, the kind that started with, like, you know, wizardry and all that good stuff, and is now, I suppose, a more popular genre thanks to things like Etrian Odyssey, Persona Q, lots of games like that. And this one is actually a really, really good entry. I went in, and the art style is not something I'm used to, so I was kind of like, okay, so this might be a little, like, I don't know, cheese ball, or just really meant for one kind of, you know, aesthetic appreciation. That is to say, people who are looking for these sort of, what do they call, moe anime, like, sort of little girls with weapons the size of trucks, that kind of thing. But no, it's super in depth. And I'll get into that in just a second. So the storyline is basically that, for whatever reason, you play a guy who is supposed to represent you, and he's kind of a drip. He's just this kind of guy that just, like, kind of, he befriended this girl called Alice, and you quickly find out, once you start to get to know the characters, that the ladies in this game, who are called Blood Maidens, are fashioned after certain, like, old school literature female, like, protagonists. So you've got, like, Alice in Wonderland. You've got Little Red Riding Hood. Literally, she's called Red Riding Hood. And Gretel, who has a giant scythe, I imagine, for eating gingerbread.
And, so she cuts it.
Yeah, exactly, with a giant scythe. So, the opening of the story is basically these two, ragamuffin teenage adult children are trapped in a jail, held in place by these weird mutants that they call Marchands, who, apparently they're like this kind of post-apocalyptic mutation of humans or something like that. The jail itself, we come to find out, is an organism. So, it has its own, like, sort of consciousness, even though it looks like a jail. Like, apparently it tries to mimic, like, the look of buildings and things like that. So everything is very off-kilter and weird looking. You know, buildings with eyes and things like that. It's legit, like, nightmarish, but also kind of like neon and cool, like futuristic, and, you know, it's kind of this mix of overstimulation. And so you get rescued from that part of the jail and taken to a safe part of town, where you find out that there's a group of people, namely the other Blood Maidens, who are trying to get everyone out of there. And so you join them, and, you know, that's how the story progresses. It's basically tackling the jail one area at a time, sort of like dungeon floors. And then that's where, like, the actual meat of the game comes in, and that's the insane amount of, like, collectibles and different systems and just all kinds of good stuff. I would say it was right at the level where I was like, any more would be too much stuff. I would be like, please, no more content. You're too much frosting on this cake. But it's exactly that right time. So not only do you have the ability to enhance your characters and your characters' weapons through common items that are dropped by enemies called blood jewelry, because blood's a big theme in this game. It's bright pink, and the girls lick it off each other. Not even joking. Because it's kind of like that kind of game, too.
Interesting. So, I guess, yeah. It earns the M rating?
No, it's not like that. It's just like, oh, I have to lick all this blood off of you to regain health and boost other stats. I'm like, well, oh.
I meant in the term of, like, sexual themes and blood.
No, they're super, like, it's, like I said, it's kind of moe. It's like it's adult, but they pass it off as being cutesy. And like, oh, how inconvenient that you have to lick all this blood off of me. This bright pink goo. And it's not even shown graphically. It's just, like, it's talked about. But there's that system. And, like, that's that the whole thing about blood in the game is that, like, you're supposed to overkill the enemies. That is to say, do way more damage than can be allowed so that they explode in this blood that covers up the dungeon. And since the dungeon is a living thing, that increases, like, a gauge for its hunger. And every time it's full, if you've exploded enough enemies, then that gives you some nice bonuses. So that's kind of the way they handle the interface that, like that. So not only do you have, a way to level up your characters, their items, all kinds of stuff, you also have a job system, which actually has to be unlocked through gathering other items and also what they call permissions. So you kind of slowly build into, like, getting several jobs for these girls. And of course, each one comes with a costume change.
Obviously.
And yeah, it's just like, oh, and of course there's, so Compile Heart, and I think also Idea Factory, I know for sure Compile Heart has dealt with, like, dating sims and stuff in the past. So there actually is a slight dating sim aspect to it, is that you can gather special items as the boy protagonist to give to the girls and increase their affection rate. And the game tells you right off the bat that it affects the ending, how many girls like you. So it's like constant gift giving as well. And it is interesting because the guy, at least as far as I played, never actually takes part in the battles. He can, like, physically defend one of the girls and then get knocked out for the rest of the battle. And he's more or less just there to react to everything. So, like I said, it's confusing to me that there's a protagonist that you play in this game that's that useless. And, you know, I'm kind of like, is he just there because they're reminding you that guys are supposed to be playing this game? Is that what it is?
Maybe. Or maybe it's just saying that men are useless, which we kind of are.
That's true. It's very, very true. And, yeah, uselessness aside, I mean, this game was really fun. I was able to dump, like, 4 or 5 hours into it every time I played. And, man, it was just, like, it really pulls you in. And if you're a fan of, like, Etrian Odyssey, it's a good one to do because, it's a lot like that, although it is a little simpler, but some of the enemies can get pretty hard. And yeah, they bring in things like the invincible monster that you have to run away from rather than fight until a certain point anyway. But the cool thing about that is that you have to run away from them and they take away your map. So you have to actually remember where you can go, or you have to use landmark things, you know? So I felt like, personally, having played through most of the Etrian Odyssey games, I was really interested in the ways that it deviated, which is enough for sure that I would want to actually finish this game.
Nice. So the cliff notes I'm getting is first-person dungeon crawling RPG, incredibly addictive, packed full of content, and proves without a shadow of a doubt that men are useless.
Yes.
Cool. So for $40, what's your verdict?
Hey, I mean, $40 is that's the price of admission for most quality RPGs on the Vita, so I mean, if it sounds interesting to you, you know, check out a few screenshots, maybe watch a video or two, and then get it, because it will, it definitely has the makings of like a 100+ hour game.
Nice.
There's so much you can do with it, and it's all fun. It's not really a tedious grind like, you know, some of those games can get.
Sounds good. I am definitely going to have to grab that one myself, because I've done so much Etrian where it's like bright colors and happiness and forests that I just need something fucked up to play. And this,
it is,
this
yeah,
sounds it like is it that. Fits the bill.
Yes, it is exactly that. Yeah, the Etrian Odyssey games, which by the way, 5's coming out probably by the time this podcast goes out. So I'm excited about that. But yeah, they usually get, you have to get like 40 or 50 hours into an Etrian Odyssey before it actually starts getting in like super intense in the ambiance.
All right, sounds good. Next game to talk about, I'm going to handle one quick, is called Semispheres, developed by Vivid Helix, published by Vivid Helix and East Asia Soft, depending on the region that you are in. Released September 10th on the PS Vita for $9.99, and a physical version is available exclusively on PlayAsia for $24.99, limited to only 2,000 units. Have no idea if it's still in stock. I probably should have checked that before recording, huh?
Maybe.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Semispheres is a meditative parallel puzzle game that places dual realities at the heart of its challenge. Its unique single-player split-screen mechanic challenges your brain by putting you in control of two characters at the same time. Our friend Greg Middleton wrote in his review, and this is what he's got to say. Semispheres is a puzzle game where you guide two colored orbs to their designated circles to complete the level. One color is controlled with the left stick, the other with the right stick. There are 13 chapters, each containing as many as 5 levels. The game has unique perspective with characters side by side in what looks like identical environments, but with enemies and object pickup in different locations. Enemies are very similar to the guards in Metal Gear Solid series, but think of the minimap view instead of the 3D models within those games. The guards' colored orbs are like your characters, but with a flashlight area visibility to see and catch you. So you ask, how do I get around these? Well, I'm glad you asked. Throughout the level, there are pickups. They range from transportation devices that take you to the opposite side of the level to a sound wave device that alerts guards, creating a distraction so you could quickly move around them. My favorite pickup was probably the portal device that allows you to access the other side of the level without the guard seeing you. With this, you could then activate the sound wave pickup and distract the guard away from your other character. The puzzles are easy in the beginning, but soon become much more complex and require the use of pickups and distractions in particular order to succeed. With so many levels, you would think the game is long, but the levels can be completed within a few minutes, with the duration being a bit longer during the later chapters. Visually, the game is beautiful, with vibrant blue and orange throughout. The ambient sound plays to it well, creating a relaxing puzzle environment that doesn't feel annoying or overly punishing when levels get more intricate. In terms of replayability, there isn't much. Once you've completed all the chapters, you can start over again from the beginning. There's even a trophy to complete the game within 35 minutes if you want to test yourself. My personal opinion is a bias. Some people on the fence may want to either check out some gameplay videos and get the control scheme to get a better idea of the mechanics. This title's tricky to explain within a review, and maybe once you've seen the game in action, you'll hopefully agree with me. It's a game not to be skipped. So thank you, Greg, for that. I know I've enjoyed the game as well, so it is good to hear that other people enjoy it themselves.
It's got blue and orange. How can you go wrong?
I know, seriously. Everything thrives with blue and orange.
Exactly. The Mass Effect effect.
And then the other game that you're here to talk about is called Symphony of Eternity, developed by Worldwide Software, published by Kemco. So, of course, you're here to talk about it.
Of course.
Released October 5th on the 3DS for $7.99. Christ is on a... Christ? Is it Christ? Is this about Jesus? Christ is on a quest with his golem friend Dauturu to find Regratlute?
Sure.
All right, Kemco, you got to cool it with some of these names. Which is said to be able to grant any wish. On their travels, they come across a young lady being attacked by demons and rescue her. What fate awaits them and the mysterious young lady? Find the legendary weapon in a fantasy RPG full of drama with monsters, elves, dwarves, and golems. Chris, what'd you think of Symphony of Eternity?
All right, well, Symphony of Eternity was an interesting one, considering it's coming from Kemco.
I noticed there's a different developer instead of Hitpoint or X-Create.
Yeah, and I hadn't really had a chance to look them up or anything, so whoops. but it's Kemco, so you know that there's a certain stamp of quality on it. And yeah, so I played this one, and it's got some choices in it that I still haven't quite wrapped my head around. So it's your basic RPG where, you know, you're running around a dungeon, enemies are on map, kind of Lufia style, where, you know, they're there, they might come after you, but, you know, you can avoid them if possible. And the battles are, you know, side to side. You can choose to attack. Sometimes, if you choose two attacks at the same, like, and both the characters are close enough on this gauge that goes by, then they can do like a combo strike or something like that. You know, it's standard fare. The thing that I thought was interesting is that the actual sprites of the characters in the areas where you move, in dungeons and in the town are extremely small. Like, I would say smaller than a Game Boy Color game in terms of, like, just sitting there looking at the screen being like, where am I? And the other thing about it is that, like, every scene has a map on the bottom. So, you know, like typical DS RPGs. And usually the maps are barely bigger than the actual thing that you're walking around in.
Interesting.
So I was like, what is this perspective? It's like, it's just the map, but 30% bigger. And then after the first dungeon, I found myself on the overworld and suddenly my character sprite was huge. Like, you know, it was like a whole different thing, like a whole different animated thing. And it was like, I was just befuddled basically by the choice. It's not that it looks bad. It's just like, why? Like, why couldn't you do it in reverse? You know, it's like the overworld's where you're supposed to be small and in the dungeons where you're supposed to be big. But either way, yeah, I started playing through this game, and it has a really interesting story. Of course, it's actually got likable characters, which I like. Sometimes these games play around with making you sympathetic to real jerk faces, whereas you're just kind of like, you know, you kind of deserve whatever happens to you. But in this game, everybody's nice, and like everything's like well explained, which I like. And like taking it back to the mechanics a little bit, this also had a really bold choice that so character growth is handled in levels as usual, and you start off with your HP in like the 800s or 900s. So whereas, you know, your magic is much less so. So again, there's a weird balance thing there. But once you start gaining levels, you actually gain points that can be distributed amongst your stats however you wish. And the game also has a job system where if you pick up certain items that you can even buy in shops and stuff. So like you buy a book and it says knight. And if you equip that book to your character in a special screen, he will start to learn the moves of a knight. They'll all be unlocked as long as you have that book. But if you change the book, then, you know, it's like the Final Fantasy V job system. It's like you can learn these skills, and then those skills can transfer to your next job. But as long as you're in the job, you can use everything that's available. And, you know, there are actually like maybe 4 or 5 moves per book. So it's kind of nice that you don't really get bogged down. It's kind of easy to learn like all the regular moves in the job so that you don't actually get bogged down like spending 5 hours trying to become a master knight before you move on to thief, you know?
Yeah.
But the interesting thing, as I said, about the stat growth is that it's never permanent. So let's say you gain 3 levels and you've now got 3 bonus points that you can distribute to stats. You can like put them into your strength while you're a knight. And then once you turn into a thief, or even while you're still a knight, you can take them out of that and put them in a different stat so that your characters are always moldable. And I've never seen an RPG do that. Like, it's always like, well, you get 1 point to put wherever you want, and you put it in strength, and like, well, okay, you're stronger now, forever. But now you can be like, I want to take 10 points out of strength and put them into magic since I'm turning into a mage now. And game's like, all right, cool with me. And then it lets you do that.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. And also to counterpoint the fact that, like I said, the graphics are a little bit weird in the sense that they're small and, you know, confusing. It's that the music is glorious. The music is this, like, CD quality. I want to say it sounds like a Sega CD game, because Sega CD games were never too much to look at in terms of the RPGs, but they always sounded amazing. And this one has a full-on vocal theme as a theme song, like when you first turn it on. It's got like this kind of anime intro and stuff. And the music throughout is just like really, really belies like the way the game looks. So it looks average, but sounds fantastic, to sort of simplify the aesthetic part of it. But yeah, it's really been interesting, like, checking out all the different jobs, because you wind up, like, within the first hour of the game, you've already got, like, 5 or 6 jobs that are available to you. And sometimes you can just find them in chests. Like, I'm not sure how many jobs there are by the end of this game, but if it's anything like, the first part of the game, it should be plenty. So, I'm having a lot of fun with this one. It's really good. The battles are actually kind of hard. The boss battles are fairly intimidating. You really have to, like, I was throwing everything at this boss and he just kept going. So it took me a while to, like, eventually take him down. So the challenge is there. And like I said, it's definitely, something where you want to, like, check out all the jobs and, like, you know, get all those skills and stuff like that. And, you know, find out the story. It's typical fare. You know, you're trying to find the item. You befriend the princess who also needs the item because of something really bad that happens at the beginning of the game that she wants to undo. And you, along the way, meet some friends, including this girl who's, like, really obsessed with the main character for whatever reason. And also she has, like, this lady golem robot person with her that's more or less the adult nice. In that relationship, which is kind of great. And, yeah, you know, you just go through and try to find, you know, you have to find this item, you have to find these elemental crystals, which I guess is where the whole elemental part of it comes in. And yeah, looking forward to playing through the rest of this, and it's a good one.
Nice. Something interesting I also noticed is that in a change with Kemco releases, this one's only $8 instead of 10.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if that's the developer, if maybe they're newer or something like that. But it felt like a Kemco, like, $10 game. So, I mean, shaving that extra dollar off is just a bonus, I'd say.
From what I see, Worldwide Software has been around since 2003, mostly with mobile games. I believe this might be their first... well, it's not their first handheld because they did a PSP game. But looking at their history... Mobile, iOS, Android, Android, iOS, iOS, mobile, mobile, mobile. So it looks like they're mostly mobile focused. So maybe since this is one of their first games available outside of a phone, maybe that's why they went with a cheaper price. But either way, $8, what's your verdict?
Yeah, $8. If you're curious about this game, I mean, it's good. You should check it out. I would look at videos and pictures, make sure that the graphics are something you can hang with. Like, if you say that it's mostly mobile, I could just imagine that they probably didn't spend a whole lot of time changing up all the... Because the graphics look like they would work on mobile.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the fact there's also the map there, which is almost the same size. And I'm sure that they were just like, well, this is what we're doing with this other screen. And that's really consistent with all of Kemco's stuff. Like, they always have the touchscreen map.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably what it is. But yeah, go ahead and pick it up if you like Kemco RPGs. This one's right up there with them.
Sounds good. And I really, really hope my microphone was picking up my cat Pork. Just meow, meow. I don't know if he sees a bug in the house or what, but he's going crazy right now.
That's funny.
Pork, what the hell do you want?
I can hear him.
I hope the mic gets that. Well, Chris, thanks so much for talking about these two RPGs. Do you have any final words to sum it all up?
Yeah, keep them coming. I love RPGs.
All right, next up, we're bringing in our good friend Cole Martin to do a couple of games. Cole, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
It's been a wonderful weekend.
What are those mouthful of dicks kind of weekend?
Oh, always. Anyway, you are here to talk about a couple of games with us today, and we're going to kick things off with Raid World War II, developed by Lion Game Lion, published by Starbreeze. It released September 26th on Steam, October 10th on Xbox One and PS4 for $39.99. Four prisoners of war, Sterling, Rivet, Kurgan, and Wolfgang, have been freed by Mrs. White, a secret British intelligence operative who needs someone to take down Hitler and the Third Reich once and for all. Their objective is to fight the war without rules or mercy. Their reward is all the Nazi gold they can carry. Nazis, this feels pretty timely, doesn't it?
It's incredibly topical.
The Nerzies.
Given today. Yeah.
So tell me about Raid.
Raid is basically if you took the movie Inglourious Basterds and made a game. That's pretty much what you've got here. You've got your little ragtag group of four mercenaries. They're each from different countries. You've got an American, a Russian. You have a defected SS soldier. And you have a little British fella. Please don't ask me to put their names with their nationalities. I didn't make a note of that one for some reason. But each individual character is also a specific class type. You have, you know, recon, assault, insurgent, and demolitions. With each specific class, you can you have a Warcry ability, so kill certain amount of Nazis and you will fill this little meter, and you can go into Warcry mode. So the different types of specialties are, like, the recon has aim assist. There will be one specific ability that is given to the character that you are playing as, and then one team ability associated with each class. So you take your group, like I said, it's four player, it's cooperative multiplayer, however you can play offline solo. And basically Mrs. White will give you missions, and it's very Left 4 Dead, Vermintide-ish, in that you just go through the mission, get in, complete the objective, and then escape out.
And clearly, there's going to be a lot of comparison to Payday as well, since Starbreeze is behind Payday, well. And they're publishing this game, which I could definitely see the comparisons. It feels like the hub world is very similar to Payday. Mm-hmm. The four distinct classes, it has a very Payday, like even the level layouts have a very Payday feel, even though it's not just go in, get treasure, and leave. Like, there's actual missions to do in the game.
Are the levels in Payday randomized?
I don't believe so. It's been a while since I played Payday, but I'm pretty sure they're just levels.
They are randomized in Raid, and this is one thing that kind of threw me off. Even though I knew it, I kind of just forgot it. And when we loaded up a mission, and I was like, oh, I already did this one, I'm going to blow through it, I know where everything's at, and then we started, and I just walked into a gate because I didn't know where I was. And then you guys all went off toward the mission, and I'm standing there going, well, this wasn't here last time. I don't understand. I'm a little dumb. So, but it is randomized, which is nice because you can play these over and over if you can get the servers to work. If the game doesn't crash on you.
Yeah,
you won't mind.
I know we normally talk about all the good stuff first, and there is some good stuff in this game to talk about, mm-hmm. but there is a lot of technical jankiness with this game. There was a stretch of time, not even 5 minutes, I would say, that my game mm-hmm. crashed three separate times.
And mine crashed as well, but you crashed far more often. I don't know what specifically you did to piss off the raid gods. But they weren't happy with your play.
I don't even know either. Like, the one time it happened, we were doing a driving mission, which that's a whole mm-hmm. other story for another day. we got back to the base. I went to get out of the vehicle, and my system just crashed to the dashboard. Complete, hard crash. And, you know, you finished the mission, and I'm sitting there like, why did you finish the mission? I said to wait till I got back in. And you're like, oh, well, this exit area thing clearly isn't the end of the area. But
I struggle with directions.
But after that, we rejoined, and someone went to join our game, and I think it froze everybody.
It froze, yeah.
And then everybody a third time, it locked up again on me. And I think that it only happened to me that time.
Yeah, that one was all on you. I only had the one crash when somebody joined. And to be fair, there had been other instances of people joining that didn't cause me to crash. It lagged a little, but it didn't full-on crash.
Yeah, there was a scary one where it got to 98% the one time, and then it just hung for 30, 40 seconds, and then the guy came in and everything continued on. So after those three mishaps, we still played together for well over an hour with no other crashing issues. But there clearly are some technical issues in terms of crashing. Even the game itself, it just has a very janky, unpolished feel to it.
Yeah, and it starts pretty early when you can't skip that cutscene. You're just like, it's a little depressing to have to sit and watch the same, especially when the game is crashing over and over, and then you have to rewatch that scene. Don't get me wrong, that's a kick-ass scene.
Yeah, there's some great cutscenes in the game. A lot of really, really good, funny humor in there. The Hitler stuff. This is weird to say. The Hitler stuff is hilarious.
I've never laughed so hard at Hitler in my life, and I feel horrible for that. I swear I am not a Nazi and I am not okay with that shit. But
oh my God, you're a Trump supporter.
In those scenes, no, I'm not even close to it. But whoever played Hitler in those scenes was really good.
Yeah. And by the way, these aren't animated cutscenes. They have full live action cutscenes in the game that are hilarious.
If you do well, Hitler gets pissed and something bad happens to him. And if you do poorly, he laughs at you and he's like, ah, I knew they couldn't do it. Ah, you know, there's different scenes and there's a multitude of them of whether you did well or not.
Indeed. God, where the hell was I?
We got lost on funny Hitler, which is just a horrible fucking thing to say. But there are 14, I think, if I counted correctly. I probably didn't. Somebody's going to correct me, and that's fine. But there are somewhere around 14 raids available. So there's plenty to do. There's a lot of missions. There's a lot of objectives and side missions.
Especially because the raids are split up into multiple missions to do. And they do a good job of changing it up. Like, one of them will be to, you know, just take out these guns at a train station that's like quick in and out kind of deal. Mm-hmm. Others are longer, more involved, where you have to go through this gigantic compound and destroy a blimp. And then there's some driving missions, which the driving in this game it needs work.
I think we were all would jump in the car and then see we were the driver and just immediately abandon the car and be like, nope, 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 and wait for somebody else to get in the driver's seat.
A Klubowagen.
Last one in was a rotten egg.
Klubowagen. Yeah, it just ended up of me driving all the time because I could at least somewhat manage it. The handling on the vehicle is rough. There was one point where I was driving down a road and a Nazi truck came at us and it just knocked the truck in the air and like barrel rolled a couple. I think it was all in first person, so I couldn't really see all the fun that happened. But it was, you know, when it was all said and done, I think our vehicle was upside down and we were still in it. And then it just respawned to normal with us still in it. Like it was, I don't know. I was not a fan of the driving sections in the game.
It was just incredibly janky, for lack of another word. Yeah. Just, you weren't really sure what was going to happen. It was not smoothly animated. That's a good way to say it. If you do play solo, you can play with three bots. They are not always the smartest AI. You can, for some reason, sometimes they will revive you, and that's fantastic. And other times they will let you die 3 centimeters from the escape box. And that's a huge pain in the ass, because then Hitler laughs at you. So, like, having to replay the mission was not punishment. Punishment was being laughed at by Gigabox Hitler.
Yeah, but, I'll say this. If you weren't a fan of the AI in the Payday games, make sure you have friends for Raid, because the AI is not that impressively good.
I played solo, and then we played as a group, and I far more enjoyed the game as a group. It was just so much more functional, and you know, you guys were helpful in that, you know, if you opened boxes and there was ammo, because I was constantly running out of ammo, and you guys would be like, oh, it was over here, as where the AI will just do stroll off right past all of the boxes, and you're left sitting there lockpicking all the boxes while the Nazis descend upon you.
I like the fact that I used a shotgun with a maximum of 30 bullets, and you ran out of ammo significantly more frequently than me.
Yeah. I was using the carbine, but once I started using the LMG, I don't remember the proper name. I think it was the Bar or something like that. It went much better, but the carbine just does not do the amount of damage that you think an assault rifle is going to do. And that was one thing that kind of bothered me. I don't feel like the weapons were particularly balanced. I could take somebody down with 2 hits from the Bar, but I could sit and put 4 shots from the carbine in a head and not even get a headshot. I'm like, okay, well, next. You know.
By the way, I enjoy the fact that headshots in this game result in a disappearing head, because it just gets obliterated.
The head literally pops off. Yeah. Yep. There's even an achievement, I think, for removing 100 limbs. I got it when we were playing. So that's much easier with the LMG as well. But yeah, there's one for removing 100 limbs. Yeah, anyway.
I know we've griped about the game quite a bit, because technically it's, you know, there's a lot of issues technically with the game. But gameplay-wise, I still had a lot of fun. When things were working and, you know, we had the three of us and then that fourth random guy who was just hanging out. Mm-hmm. Like, it played really well. It was really fun. Lots of laughing, lots of cursing, only part of it directed at the technical issues of the game. But I still enjoyed it. Like, I had a lot of fun when things were working, but that's the big qualifier, when they were working.
It was just that the constant crashing was a big detriment. And so it's easy to complain about it. Well, it crashed all the time. But it was fun, and I did enjoy it. And because of that, I want to give it a really tentative try, it because it was fun. It's just, it needs patched desperately. Yeah.
If they could get some patches out to smooth out the experience, make it a better running product, try to cut down on some of the crashes with the game, let us skip that opening cutscene earlier than like 30 seconds into it. There's just so many quality of life improvements it could get. If they could get those, this could be a really, really good recommendation. But as it stands at $40 with how technically rough it is right now, I agree with you. It's a hesitant try it. There's just
it depends on how much you're willing to put up with potential multiplayer and crashing and. Yeah.
And if you have friends.
Otherwise, it's fun. Yeah, if you have friends. Because seriously, fuck the bots.
But for real, if anyone picks up the game and you want something to play with, let Cole and I know, because I will gladly jump in and play some more.
I would happily play more.
Cool. Next game to talk about is Decay the Mare, developed and published by Shining Gate Software. This one released October 13th on Xbox One for $9.99, previously on Steam. Sam is an addict who ends up in an institution named Reaching Dreams, hoping to kick his drug problem and sort out his miserable life. But during the first night, something goes horribly wrong, and he gets stuck in an endless what? That's where my description ends. What the?
Joe, please.
What happens?
You know what? It doesn't matter because everything in that description's a lie.
What? Okay, then. No. Then what is this game? What's going on?
Decay, the mayor, is the story of somebody named Sam that is at Reaching Dreams. But that's about where it ends. Not everything else is as it seems. You do experience nightmares, and it's kind of up to the player to unravel what parts of what you see are nightmares and what of what you see is reality. And you may be not even pleasantly surprised, because this is a grim horror game. Shockingly surprised at how it really ends up. I will say, without giving any spoilers, the ending to this game was so unbelievably satisfactory. Like, it was a twist ending, and I just sat there after everything was said and done, and my jaw was on the floor. I was just like, there was one tiny little plot hole, and I can't talk about it without giving away anything. It was one tiny little plot hole. It was just a small detail that kind of got under my skin a little. But for the remainder of the story, everything just gets smoothed out, and you just feel completely satisfied with how it turns out. You're just like, there's a good ending and a bad ending. So obviously I'm talking of the good ending, but just, even the bad ending still fills in enough of the details that you'll be like, holy shit, I didn't see that coming. And I didn't expect that out of this game at all. When you first approached me about this game, I thought it was going to be like your 3D walking sim, occasional find clues, here's a puzzle type. But it's not. It looks it, and it is first person, but it is a point and click. And so you have these various scenes in different rooms, and that is another one of the downsides to the game, is that You're exploring the the rehabilitation center, the rehab that Sam is in, and there's a lot of dark corridors, and the graphics are kind of low quality, and everything's a little grainy. Beyond the point of just how it's supposed to be aesthetically grainy to make it a little spooky, it's just kind of subpar graphically. And so all the doors you encounter kind of look the same. And when you're exploring areas that are dimly lit and there's not much in the way of landmarks for the rooms, it's very easy to get lost and just find yourself going, I know I've gone in this door 743 times, but I'm going to go two more just to be sure it's the right way.
Nice. Well, I know you mentioned that it was a spooky game. Normally with horror games, I have a very specific question for you. And this time, I believe you have a different answer than usual. Did you fear pee?
I did. I did. And not even because I... Okay. There's three episodes. There are three episodes. And in the middle of the second episode, you have to go through an area that is completely dark. And if you have solved the previous puzzles properly, you are armed with a camera. Like a Polaroid. And so you take a picture of the room, and the flash lights it up enough that you can, for a second, see where you're going. So, and since it's point and click, obviously that just moves you to the next scene. And there's three or four scenes in this one area that you must move through. You don't have to collect anything in these areas because, of course, it's pitch black and all that. But you can't move forward to get out of it without using the camera. I saw something when I was leaving this area that wasn't there when I went through it the first time. And it scared me. And I fear Pete, and I screamed, and my kids heard me.
That sounds like a ringing endorsement.
Yeah, it really is. I wish the graphics had just been a little better, but in all reality, I really liked this game. It was, the puzzles were, they weren't difficult to the point where, like, you want to pull your hair out because you can't figure it out, but they were creative. Like, in some instances, you would need a code, and you would have to use, like, a magnifying glass to see the code, but it would be upside down. And so you would need to flip it. But, of course, it would be numbers that wouldn't look upside down. So you'd think it was, I think it was 6861 that it looked like, but it was really 1981 that you need. So, you know, you could sit there forever and just type in 6861 and be pissed it wasn't working until you thought about it differently and flipped it around. While it seems like Sam's rehabilitation is the major focus, it's not entirely true. And the first episode, everything is incredibly weird and erratic, and it's almost like they didn't have any kind of idea of where they were going with it. But by the time you get to episode 2, there's an actual mystery that has evolved out of the chaos of episode 1. And by episode 3, it starts to finally make sense. So it's a slow burner of a game, in that if you only play that first episode, you're going to be like, I have no idea what the fuck this is. This is the worst thing I've ever seen. Why did this? Who even made this? By the end, though, you're like, I have questions. Who hurt these people?
So basically, this is something that if you're going to go into it, you got to make sure to see it through to the end.
Yes, see it through to the end. Play it, because I kid you not, the solution to it all makes so much sense, and it's just such a shock, and it's really well done.
So anyway, I guess the big question is, since it's something you've got to see through to the end for $10, if people have the time and money for this, what is your verdict?
I give it a buy. It's actually a pretty quick game. I think I probably did it in under 3 hours, and that was without a guide. And then, even still, I only missed one achievement in my playthrough. So, with a guide, I was able to go back and get that in, like, 30 seconds.
Nice.
When I saw the one I missed, I was like, oh, come on. And, it related to that camera, but yeah.
And if Shining Gate Software is looking for a quote for their trailer, just, I fear peed, the SMO podcast. I fear peed. last game. I had
my pants.
The last game you're here to talk about is called Guardians of the Galaxy Episode 4, developed and published by Telltale Games. It released October 12th for $4.99, part of the season pass. A lot of story to this, so just give us the info.
How do I normally feel about Episode 4?
You always are least favorable of Episode 4s because it's like the calm before the ending storm.
This one, I'm not going to say that it broke the mold, but it did have a lot happen to a point that I actually felt like I was playing a finale more than I was playing a fourth episode. And I do believe I complained that episode 3 felt like episode 4.
Yeah, I remember that.
So, I'm not sure where it's going to go from here. And normally, at least, you, by the end of episode 4, you have some kind of idea of what to expect for 5. I don't know where this is going to go. As usual, I'll have a spoiler or so from episode 3, so That's your warning, and here I go. At the beginning of episode 4, the Eternity Forge is broken, and Hala, who was hugging her son that she tried to bring back, she absorbs the power because she is near the forge when it breaks. She absorbs that power. And now she is some kind of omnipowerful force where even when one of her soldiers touches her, he dies immediately. So the Guardians are in a pretty fucked state at the beginning of episode 4. They do manage to escape Hala at that time. And they're then forced in a cave. They become trapped in a cave after they escape from Hala, where they make a new friend, and it's up to players to find a way to get them out of there. But, of course, their new friend, as usual, leads them to more trouble. I don't think the Guardians ever manage to make a friend and just be like, yeah, we're friends now, and that's fine. This always leads to bullshit somehow. This time's no different. So they manage to get in trouble to the point that when they're trying to decide what to name their new friend, Rocket tries to name him It's a Death Trap. So you have some options, and that is one of them. The strife that we have seen building up in the series up to this point between Rocket and Gamora, that continues, and it almost kind of comes to a head. At this point, every major decision has pit the player to where they've had to choose Rocket or Gamora. It's like there's been a couple of occasions of like, oh, Gamora and Drax, but it's been primarily, are you going to side with Rocket or are you going to side with Gamora? Either way, you're going to piss one or the other off. So, for my sake, when I started playing this, I made the decision, no matter what, I was Team Rocket. Rocket wins all arguments. This was a dumb decision. Not in that it has affected anything that can't be repaired. But in that, I feel like I've shorted myself of some storylines by not weaving a little bit more. But I have taken on Team Rocket, and I am sticking to that. And this did, however, choosing to go with Rocket over Gamora, did lead to seeing some of Drax's backstory. Now, if you're familiar with Guardians, you know that Drax has lost his family. His wife and his daughter. So, with the help of Mantis, who up until this point, Mantis has served to allow Peter to visualize others' memories of their loved ones. This is how in episode 3 we saw the moments between Gamora and Nebula and Thanos. So, for episode 4, we get to see Drax and with his daughter. It's kind of a shock where that leads to with Drax, because it's incredibly emotional, that scene, but it also feels like it's kind of a sudden stop, because Drax doesn't have a huge story arc in the Guardians game.
He's
a pretty heavy background character. You can talk to him, you can interact with him, he's there. And there is the one instance where you can choose him or Gamora. But ultimately, he just kind of fills your shoes when you're not there. Like, oh, I went with Rocket, Drax went with Gamora. So, or vice versa. So it's a little odd to have such a heavy emotional point with Drax in episode 4. And have the other Guardians react to it the way that they did.
And it sounds like going any further into this would ruin the experience for there. Anyone else.
Yeah. And that's why I'm stopping there and going back to my notes. But this is definitely one of the more emotional episodes. And like I said, it just felt more like a finale, even on the stats screen at the end, some of the stats that it give, you're just like, well, you know, that's not typical until the end of the season. So what's going to happen now? You know, what's left? So I'm assuming for episode 5, we will probably have a final face-off against Halal, but I don't know how that's going to go, given the events of episode 4.
Well, I am very eager to hear how things turn out, but for $5, part of the season pass, what are your thoughts on episode 4?
I give it a buy it. I do. It's a good setup. It's a good setup for 5, because you don't know what to expect going into it.
No.
But it is also a good closure for the previous 3 episodes in a way. So if you've played the other episodes and you are looking for where this is going to end up, you definitely don't want to miss 4, because that kind of emotion that is a big part of the episode is you're gonna not want to miss that.
So all those people like you who expect the 4th episode lull, they should definitely pay attention this time around.
Yeah, I was really expecting it to just be like, okay, well, we're going to fly in space and maybe something will happen. But I put the controller down at the end of it, and I was just like, well, fuck. Now well, what?
I'm excited to hear about episode 5 whenever that one's ready. But thank you so much, as always, for coming on and talking games. And I know you'll be back soon.
Yep. You can't get rid of me.
All right, moving on. Next game to talk about is called Balance City, developed and published by Fernando Cordoba, released September 21st, 2016 on Steam for $7.99. So kind of curious why we're covering this now, but I'm guessing we might have some answers. Thanks to our good friend Tom Miller. Tom, how are you doing today, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm doing all right. This one was offered to us, and normally we don't cover older games, but if it's offered to us, I mean, we're going to cover it, right?
Yeah, I was checking it out, and it, I guess, got released over a year ago, but, you know, we're doing it, so let's go.
Was there, like, a recent patch, or was it, like, an early access thing or something?
So, I don't think it was early access. They did just, well, the last patch was a couple months ago, it looks like. They just added a new scenario, so.
No, that might be it, then.
I don't know what's going on. I guess maybe they were just trying to get the word out there a little bit.
Maybe. Well, anyway, Balance City is a city-building balance physics game. It's a mixture between old-school SimCity and Jenga. You must build the tallest towering city over a balancing platform while keeping your citizens happy. Sounds really interesting. What are your thoughts on this game?
Yeah, so, like, there are certain games where you hear the description of them and you're just like, well, I wouldn't have thought of that one, and this is absolutely one of them. So, like, the SimCity meets Jenga thing, like, that is, I feel like it came out of a game jam or something, but it's really creative, and I've never, I would never have thought of that. So what you're trying to do, so the playing field of Balance City is like, you're on this flat plane. I'm making gestures with my hand to, describe what it looks like, and that's not going to work. It
plays very well in audio form.
Yeah. Yes, but picture me holding my hand sideways like it's a table. So you're on this flat surface, and you're like suspended over this abyss. I don't know why they decided to build a city there, but whatever. And so you're on this platform that's balancing like on top of a spire. And what you got to do is you got to build a city up. And if you have too much weight on one side or the other of the platform, it'll tip over. Everybody is going to fall into the abyss. It's terrible. And the game isn't terrible, but like the fate of the people.
Everybody dying is.
Yeah, everybody dies.
Yeah. That's the terrible thing.
Yeah. So it actually does feel like sort of a simplified SimCity. You have like different, you can build houses which turn into apartments as you stack them together, and you can build different office buildings, and you got like fire and police and you know, medical stuff. So it has all the basic elements to it, but it's all side view, which is really interesting. Like, so you have to build like everything is built in the form of giant towers, and it's just kind of an interesting take on it, because you only have the one plane to think about, the one dimension that you're building on. And it's interesting because, like, you can get some fun situations, some, like, panicky situations where you accidentally put more weight than you should on one side of the platform, then you're just quickly like, oh shit, you gotta build like 10 houses immediately, like just like frantically clicking the button. And it's kind of ridiculous, but like I appreciate that they did it, that they actually made the game. So there's both a free build mode where you do whatever, and then there's also a bunch of different challenges and different scenarios like there would be in SimCity. Like you have it's like a reimagined version of real world cities. You can do like New York or San Francisco, or they just added Seattle to it. And like they each have their own problems. You gotta like, you know, make better houses or like stop things from setting on fire or do whatever. So I don't know. There's quite a bit of variety to it, but it is all very simple in the way it's presented. But the challenges I thought were like kind of the highlight of the game for me. They have stuff like, there's one where there are two islands, and one of them is like sort of like the shanty town on the lower level. And then there's like these like huge office towers where like all the rich people are, and you have to build like this massive stack of like stack of shacks to get up to the upper level and try to like take over and get the people to be able to have jobs and stuff. I don't know. It's a really weird and interesting just way that the game flows.
It reminds me a lot. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, an old board game called Topple.
I think I might have played it.
Where there's like a balancing platform on a tiny little pedestal, and you have to put little chips on there without toppling the thing over. That's what it reminds me of.
Yeah, I can totally see that.
It's such an obscure board game that I don't know if many people have heard of it.
Yeah, I think I might have like vague memories of it from when I was a kid, but I'm not sure. And there's also a nightmare scenario that they added for Halloween last year. So there's like everything is all dark, and there's like this creepy clown instead of the regular guy who like disappears from the screen and then jump scares you, which is like, I never thought I would have a jump scare in a SimCity game, but here we are. And then I went to a different level.
I do like the look of the game. I appreciate the fact that they have these different scenarios with different city landmarks that you can include in. Yeah. So what did you think of this game for $8? What do you think of it?
So it's a super novel idea for a game, and it's fun to play around with. But like the one thing I haven't mentioned is that like you have disasters like in a SimCity game, but like in a game where it's all physics based and like all 2D and all on one plane, like I don't know if you've ever played Jenga and like there was a big earthquake in the middle of the game, but you're not playing Jenga anymore after that. So it's like, it does feel sort of, there's like some sort of cheap feeling difficulty, which is, kind of a hit against it. But like, it is such a weird and cool idea that like, if you're into puzzle games, into like physics based stuff, I'd say it's probably worth a shot. And, because it's older, it's probably going to be pretty easy to find on sale too. So I'd keep an eye on it if it's something that sounds interesting to you.
Sounds good. Plus it's only $8 to begin with. So
yeah, exactly.
Cool. Sounds good. The other game you are here to talk about is called A Hat in Time, developed and published by Gears for Breakfast. It released October 5th on Steam for $29.99, coming later this fall to Xbox and PS4. In A Hat in Time, you play as a tiny space-traveling girl with a big top hat. Her adventure is halted when all her fuel is lost and scattered across a nearby planet. Hat Kid must now jump, fight, and stitch new hats to make her way into every nook and cranny of this new world in order to restore her fuel and resume her journey. What did you think of A Hat in Time?
Oh, man, this game. Okay, so a little bit of history. Like, I remember seeing this game when it was first announced, and they had like the very first playable build. And I know I saw somebody on YouTube. I think it might have been like Northern Lion or somebody playing the first demo of it. And I was thinking like, you know, it looks okay. If it gets polished more, it'll probably be worth playing. And then, like, it kind of dropped off my radar. And then, like, 3 years later, it finally came back, and it's like, holy shit, this game looks amazing. And they were polishing the hell out of it. And, like, I don't know. It's one of the most just, like, instantly charming games I've ever played. Like, the levels are, they're huge. They're super detailed. They have such nice, like, atmospheric touches to them, but also a great sense of humor. And every stage that I played really does bring something new to the table. So the influences of this game are like, the main things they say are Banjo-Kazooie and Super Mario Sunshine. So like old school, like collectathon platformers. Mm-hmm. And it really does take more, I think, from the Mario side of things where you have like, you visit each world several different times, but each time it has different elements that are changed. And it really does. It often makes it feel, well, sometimes you are literally playing a different level in every act of a world, but sometimes you, you know, there are different environmental changes, like the weather has changed, or in one level, like all the water gets replaced by lava because that happened. But it's just everything in it has like so much charm and so much joy put into it. And it also controls great. Like in a 3D platformer, if you have bad controls, like, you're done. But, like, it's so fluid. You have, like, a really simple move set, but you get the different hats over time, which give you different moves. And so, like, but everything's just so tight. And you have, like, there are some really weird, like, complicated platforming bits, but even that, it doesn't feel unfair because, like, you know that the controls are just right there. And there's some weird camera stuff, but it's 3D platformer, and so there will be weird camera stuff every once in a while. You know. Yeah, so, okay, one more thing, and then I want to get to a point that I wanted to make, but I want to do one more, like, really positive thing about this game first.
I know what you're getting to, and...
yeah.
Like, I've heard so much good about this game, but I've also heard that there is one thing in particular that's turning a lot of people off, and we can't just ignore that.
Yeah. So the one other thing that I wanted to mention is that the music is great. Grant Kirkhope, the composer for Banjo-Kazooie, is not on this game. I think he actually did write a few tracks for it, but he was gonna be part of it, and then he dropped off. But the composer, Pascal Michael Stiefel, he just knocked it out of the park. There is like, he wrote 78 tracks. The soundtrack is available as side download on Steam as well for $10, which nice. Is totally worth it. It fit perfectly. Okay. So as you can tell, like this game a lot. One of my favorite 3D platformers in a long time. As part of the Kickstarter, they had an incentive where you could, get a voiceover cameo in the game. The voiceover cameo went to a guy who goes by the name JonTron, who you might know from a lot of things. He was on Game Grumps for a while and did, you know, YouTube, and then he, like, did a bunch of shit.
Went insane.
Yeah, he was, like, he was all into, like, the whole Gamergate thing, and he made all these racist-ass rants, and he had a feature on Breitbart, and that just sucks. And it's weird because it's such a small part that he has, and, like, you might not even talk to the character, but, like, it just added this whole weird, like, layer of mental gymnastics to the game that was just kind of a buzzkill to me, you know?
Yeah. I've heard a lot of other people mention that it just took them out of the experience. They were having such a good time with the game, but just his reputation and his persona just left such a bad taste in their mouth that running into his character in the game just, it didn't ruin the game for them, it just affected it. Like, yeah. it just left a sour taste of like, why?
Yeah, why? I don't know. And like, I came back and I mean, I I kept playing it because I love the game and I still enjoyed it, but it just added this layer of weirdness to it, you know? And, I mean, obviously your mileage will vary on it. Like, I don't know. I'm personally pretty bad at separating the art and the artist and stuff. And, you know, if it's not a thing to you, then it's not a thing to you. But like, it's just kind of, it was a weird thing for me.
No. I mean, there's still people who can't go back and watch like old Chris Benoit wrestling matches because of the things that he's done. And while like murdering your family isn't the same as being featured on Breitbart, it's close. And to be fair, to play devil's advocate, it wouldn't be right to remove him from the game completely, considering he paid for that benefit and he supported the development of the game to such a financial degree that he earned that cameo. Yeah. It just, I could see where it turns people off.
Yeah. And yeah, so that was the thing that I wanted to bring up. And that was the thing that made me stressed out about doing this review for like the last week. So
the thing is, from what you've said, this is an incredible game in every single way, you know, minus some camera goofiness, which is, you know, par for the course in every 3D platformer ever made in history.
Yeah.
It's just, if you have an issue with JonTron, it might be worth not getting the game just to keep your mental stability in check, I guess. I don't know how to put it.
Yeah.
I'm bad with words.
Well, so am I.
Good thing we don't do anything that involves speaking.
Yeah, especially not a podcast or something.
Yeah, seriously. That'd be so stupid. Who would ever? But it sounds like if you don't have a problem with JonTron, it's an awesome game to pick up.
Yeah. I'd say, well, I mean, I think it's more than worth $30. And
So JonTron aside, because we have to be fair to the game and not just one of the actors. JonTron aside, $30. What is your verdict on A Hat in Time?
Oh, I think it's totally worth it. I mean, it's one of the most polished 3D platformers I've ever seen, honestly. And geez, man, I'm just always down for some collectathon, and it just does it right, you know.
Hell yeah.
So I, you know. Cognitive dissonance be damned, I have had a great time, and I would recommend it.
In an ideal world, what suggestion would you have to address the JonTron thing? Just like, be able to disable that character, or like have a toggle to make him mute, or add in the ability to kill his character, maybe?
I don't know. And I've been thinking about it, and like, there's really no way to not screw this up somehow now. Yeah.
Well, but either way, it sounds like the game is fantastic, and I am very, very much looking forward to it coming out on Xbox later on this year.
It's coming to Xbox, yeah.
And PS4. And I think there's been rumblings of a Switch release, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah.
I'd be shocked if it didn't at this point. Everything is coming to the Switch.
For sure, yeah. It would definitely have a good home there if it did get released there.
Awesome. Well, Tom, thank you so much for covering these games. I know you'll be back on again soon. Do you have any final words to wrap it all up?
Be healthy, everyone. And I'm going to be on here again before Halloween. So have a happy Halloween preparation.
All right, and finally tonight, we're going to end the show the way we usually do. Our good friend Pernell Vaughn, how are you doing tonight, sir?
Nora, I'm having a slam-tastic evening, aside from the fact that it's too close to winter and not close enough to summer. We're on the wrong side of fall, and we didn't even have a chance to experience the actual season yet. It's stupid.
I love the fact that every other episode on this show, we're discussing the weather, and either, oh my god, it was freezing tonight, or oh my god, it is so hot again. It's never just been, weather's been beautiful today. It's been mid-60s. It's just nice and light breeze. It's been beautiful. No, that doesn't happen anymore.
I think the weather is just erratic now. Either that or I'm broken. I'll take either. Either works.
Hey, either way, it, you know, what are you going to do?
Play games.
We're going to talk about games. Yeah, that's what we're going to do. So you were here to talk about two games tonight, and we're going to start with Tohu Kobuto 5 Burst Battle, developed by Cube Type, published by NIS America, released October 10th on the Nintendo Switch and the PS4 for $29.99. Jump into the world of Tohu and unleash bullet hell upon your enemies in the 1v1 shoot-em-up Tohu Kobuto 5 Burst Battle. Take control of one of 9 Tohu characters and eliminate your opponent using bullet hell patterns, melee attacks, or spell cards. Pernell, what'd you think of this game?
Tohu is an interesting game. And what I mean by that is there's not a lot of features and modes in it, but what is there is pretty like defined in the sense of like it's a fighting game, and well, bullet hell fighter. So you know what to expect. They give you what you usually get in these kinds of games, which is a story mode, which puts you through a plot line revolving around all of the Tohu characters that are in the game. Like you control different characters at different times. And then there's the arcade mode, which is just pick a guy and go through a series of battles with the intent being like almost like a survival. How long he lasts before you die. They don't refill your health, though. I believe you get a portion of it back, but not all of it. And you just keep going until you just can't beat a battle anymore. And it keeps a running record of how many wins and losses you've gotten with that character. Not wins and losses, but I meant number of consecutive wins you've gotten with that character. So what the game, how does the game actually play? Well, if you are familiar with the game Virtual on Cyber Troopers, you're pretty already close to what you're looking at here. Ooh. You have a station. Oh yeah, exactly. It's pretty interesting in that regard. The only thing I wish it had, like Cyber Trooper has, is like a more variable battlefield, like with cover and things like that. But every level is just a flat square surface with no cover. So you are a character who can do like ground or air dashes. You can do one of 3 different types of attacks that all revolve around some form of bullet pattern, like a bullet hell shooter. Like one character might have like a spray of fire or a spray of bullets that go out like a peacock feather wing and then come in and close on the opponent. Or they'll have like a large spherical orb that will chase after them, or any number of freaking things, ground chasers, homing missiles, everything. They cover all the gamuts in this game as far as like types of bullet patterns a character can have. And each character has 3 types corresponding to the A, Y, and X buttons. You'll pretty much have to get used to or familiar with all the characters to be able to pull off, you know, like a sort of Street Fighter balance, counterbalance gameplay structure, which I can't imagine a lot of people have in the mental fortitude to do. You're likely just going to pick a character you like and not die. But you can. There are also, one thing I didn't quite grasp in the overall sense of how the game works, but I know it's there, is there are super moves that can kick off based on certain phases that you are in the fight. And what has happened with it? I'll be battling a person, I'll be fighting for a period of time, and I'll hold down, say, the A button, which is one of the attack buttons, and it will eventually trigger a specialized move. The screen will freeze, it'll prop the name of the move in the corner, and I will unleash it on the opponent. And sometimes the opponent does the same thing to me where all of a sudden the game will like freeze and I'll get hit with their super move. And that's pretty much the game. It's 1-round battles, unless it's something in the options that I didn't quite grasp, but it's 1-round battles, knock down, move on. And honestly, I had fun with this game. I enjoyed dabbling around with 3 of the different characters on here. There's a total of about 9 or 10, but I dabbled with 3 of them. And overall, I was having fun with it because it invokes feelings of Virtual on Cyber Troopers, a game type that I haven't played in a while. And quite frankly, if you're listening to this podcast and you don't like Virtual on, I'm sorry, you're missing out. So the game itself is $30. Again, like I mentioned before, there's an arcade mode and a story mode. Those are the primary modes in the game. If you are okay with that in a fighting game, that is cool. You can have that. But for the most part, just know what you're getting going in. That's all there really is to it. As long as you're content with the fact that that's what the game has to offer, I think you'll have some joy. You'll have a lot of fun with this game because you're coming in knowing that you want to play with this series of characters. And also, it's $30, which is, I won't say budget priced, but it's middle ground priced.
Yeah.
Which, you know, itself is a good thing. So.
Yeah, it's not packed with features, but it's also not a full price game. So you kind of have to have your expectations in check.
Exactly right.
My question is, how well does it play on the Switch?
Fantastically. How fantastically does it play? I'm playing it right now while I'm talking to you. And I'm having no problems doing so. The controls are fine. The method that I play so that people are aware of that at least is that I use the handheld mode. I almost exclusively play Switch with as handheld and handheld mode because I prefer it that way. And I've had no problems with it. Smooth frame rate, no slowdown. And thankfully with this game, that's the case because this game requires full speed motion because it's a pretty frantic brawler. It's just pleasant. Like it works well. There's no hiccups. I don't have control problems. I remember fighting the sticks. And while I know I've heard people play games where they complain about dealing with, say, the cross pad buttons on the left hand side. One, this game is, you're most likely better off with the analog any freaking way. But even with that in mind, if I'm using the cross pad buttons, I've had no issues with those either. They're pretty straightforward. Just, I don't recommend using them because you want to deal with a lot of diagonal dashing and stuff on occasion. And this thing, as you know, probably from dealing with a Switch, those cross pad buttons aren't good for diagonal movement.
Oh, man. No, not at all. Any game I think that requires a solid D-pad, you were much better off doing it docked and using a pro controller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, but thankfully I haven't even bothered with the pro controller, but I almost love hearing stuff like that because, wait a minute. You said you do prefer a pro controller?
If I need a D-pad, yes.
Oh yeah, for sure. Definitely. Yeah. I would not use these buttons for crap if I need the true D-pad control.
Mm-hmm.
This is just, and I understand why it's like that though, because it was meant to be said if you had to do the, if you had to remove them and use individual controllers, everybody has a button layout, but.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense, but, you know, it's just not ideal in all situations, but it's good to hear it works with Burst Battle. So for $30, what is your overall verdict?
If you like Toho in general and you're okay with the idea of bullet hell combat, it's a buy to me, but otherwise it's a skip because again, light on features. So if you want this game, you have to come in knowing that you're ready for specifically picking a character, learning how to use that character, and brawling against other people on preferably that use different characters. So
sounds good. I've been considering this one myself, and maybe we'll have to fight each other one of these times.
I'm going to win, but sure, that's great. Great for me.
All right, and final game tonight, Yono and the Celestial Elephants, developed by Neckbolt, published by Plugin Digital. It released October 12th on the Switch and on Steam for $14.99. Elephants are mighty protectors of the world, born from the stars once per millennium. This is the age of Elephant Yono, but Yono is still so very young and in a kingdom inhabited by feudal humans, undead bone whites, and robotic mechani. It's not easy to keep one's trunk out of trouble. Ready your trunk. It's time for an adventure. If people somehow missed our interview with Nicholas Hallen of Neckbolt when he was on the show to chat about Yono, Parnell, what is this game?
Glorious. I love Yono. It's really simple. It's a. I don't want to say RPG because that would be a disservice to the genre in this game in particular, though. But it is an adventure game starring an awesome, cute cartoon elephant that carries a very serious tone. He comes down from the heavens, and he is tasked. He has no idea what his purpose even is. He just knows that he is an elephant, and he is there to help people. He bumps into the best way to describe it is a circus girl who essentially immediately attaches herself to him and accompanies him on his quest to figure out why he's actually been summoned to this planet. In this world, elephants, as you mentioned, are celestial, magical, almost godlike creatures. And every time someone comes across them, they're almost enamored by the fact that this elephant person is running around, and they are hoping that means either a good sign or a bad, and not hoping for a bad sign because, of course, they also know what that is. And your journey across this planet involves you walking around in a Zelda-esque fashion, exploring the terrain, and essentially taking on side quests, helping people with their problems, whether it's doing a love letter slash, bouquet swap with a lovelorn couple, or doing an item transfer between families, or figuring out why this guy just can't happen to find his cool hat. There's a number of just interesting side, like small quests, and an interesting component about this game that I come to like, and we actually did address in the interview with the guy that created it, is that it has a weird emphasis on giving you nothing. And what I mean by that is rewarding you with nothing. So, physical. Rewarding you with nothing physical. I better clarify that because somebody's like, giving you nothing? What the hell am I playing this for? So, you are basically, like I said, the elephant is there. He just wants to help people. So, every once in a while, you'll be requested to do something for a person. And you'll go out of your way to go through the steps to help a person out. And sometimes you'll get a heart container piece, or whatever they call them in this game, a heart token piece, which is, you know, of course, in typical Zelda fashion, 4 heart tokens fills 1 heart token hole, which gives you an additional health container. You'll sometimes get that, but beyond that, you never really get rewarded with anything. Sometimes a person will say, hey, I got some money. You'll go, nah, I don't need that. You'll take it. And unlike other games where the game has another stage where the guy goes, no, I insist, and you get blinged out. In this game, you literally tell them, I don't want your reward. Just smile with me and let's have a good day. Sometimes you'll do a favor for a greedy person and he'll be like, here's your 1 gold, you losing elephant, you loser elephant. And you'll just like not even care. You're just like, whatever, I did my job and I'm ready to move on. And while that seems kind of annoying, and I'll admit initially it was, I just kind of embraced my inner elephant. I just enjoyed doing these small tasks for people, knowing that if the game didn't require it, I was always free to move on and just go about my business. But I wanted to interact in this world that this elephant inhabits. But aside from that, you also have to do some puzzle solving, light puzzle solving. And an interesting thing, for better or worse, about this game is that you never actually get new skills. You just gain new uses for what you already know how to do. So the elephant is capable of using his trunk to blow various things as you come across. Like, you might blow water, you might blow, you know, seed or peanuts rather, you might blow just air to accomplish multiple tasks. You have a headbutt move, which can be used to like smash out rocks or attack enemies on the field. And that's pretty much the main stuff he can do. But it's still freaking enjoyable. I enjoyed coming into an environment, seeing what the puzzle required, knowing what was at my disposal, saying, okay, let's figure this out and solve it so I can help my little buddy get further into the game. It's just genuinely fun, and it's a blue sky type title, so smiles are all over the damn place.
Yeah, the big word that comes to my mind when playing this game is wholesome.
Very freaking wholesome.
It is. It's just such a happy, friendly, like, arms open to everybody type of game. This is not the kind of game that's going to challenge you and push your skills to the limit. It's the kind of game that you're going to want to play and just smile and enjoy the experience. This isn't trying to be the latest Zelda game with, you know, action-packed combat scenes and the most brain-busting puzzles this side of the Mississippi or whatever the fuck you want to say. It is just such a happy, wholesome game that fills you with smiles and joy, and I think the world needs more games like this.
This is true, because I, as a man who loves difficult games, sometimes I don't want that. Sometimes I want the game that makes me happy. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm not even specifically saying like a dark, demonic world in need of a savior. That's also really easy to play. No, I mean the entire enchilada. I want a positive, smile-inducing game that also is not extremely challenging. Just kind of allows me to move on and experience the events within that make me happy to embrace them, not need to work to earn them. Mm-hmm. There's a time and place, and this is definitely one of those times in that place where just hanging out with my old boy Yono and get my water drunk on is a perfect idea of a good time in a game.
And the thing I love that with this being a digital game is that you could, if you have your Switch on you, you could play it anytime, anywhere. I have had, you know, between console issues, TV issues, cable box issues, windshield issues that we've had with our car. Like, we've had so much shit going wrong around our house lately that it was so nice to fire up this game and just zone out and smile and be part of a happy world of joy and friendliness for a while.
Yeah, I was about to say, you sound like you need a dose of Yona.
I do, man. I fucking...
Wait a minute, what?
I'm sure people are going to hear this episode or the episodes before it, and, like, my attitude shifts drastically from person to person and review to review based on who I'm talking with. It's just been, like, past few weeks have been soul-crushing, but games like Yona and the Celestial Elephants keep my smile on my face and just help me relax and enjoy life.
Mm-hmm. And this is that's definitely a very good way to put this game. And I think, honestly, I feel like I pretty much described it to the letter. Like, there's not a lot of stuff to go into aside from that element. Like, it's just fun.
Yeah.
Like, there's a, like, even as far as, like, feel like you might have missed a secret, like, that's not even a thing. Like, yeah, there's a K-Dur treasure chest, and there might be a side quest you might have missed here and there, but it never feels like you're pressured to do it. You're mm-hmm. just there. There's a backtracking system in the form of a railway system, but I never felt like I had to use it, except for like maybe one or two times just to kind of go back and double check a thing. I never felt compelled to need it. It's just fun mm-hmm. to progress and see my elephant fun friend be discovered. Yeah. To discover himself. It's just great.
So I guess it comes down to final question. $15. What's your verdict?
I was going to buy this game before the review came to us. That doesn't change. I still recommend other people buy it. I just now I actually have the experience to actually feel like my purchase would have been validated.
Mm-hmm. My verdict is, if you are someone who is looking for a challenge in a video game or like a hard-hitting dramatic story,
in the wrong house, fool.
Play this game anyway. Change your expectations and just
interesting.
Buy this game and enjoy it.
I love that you put a flim flam on me, because I thought you were going to go with a don't buy this if you're looking for that. You're like, no, screw that. Buy it anyway.
Gotcha, bitch.
And real life, don't need it. You flim flammed me, man.
Yeah, but like if you're in the mood for a hard hitting action packed game, you play enough of those. Change it up. Play this. Turn off Destiny, turn off Call of Duty, turn off Dark Souls, and just fire up a wholesome, friendly, family friendly, enjoyable, fun experience that'll keep a smile on your face. That's how I feel.
If you got kids, play with them too, because they got enough crap bogging them down this down days too with all the crazy Zimzam fighting games, or not fighting games, but violent games. And even though, yeah, there are some that aren't, I feel like the majority of games that aren't, like, you know, gray or whatnot, are just licensed garbage. So I want some Yona. More Yona, baby.
I agree, and fingers crossed that Nicholas is able to port it some other platforms in the future, but I think we've already gone over that it probably won't happen, but yeah. I will still hold out hope, because games this good deserve to be played by everyone.
True, though I will admit, though, based on the story he told, I am glad that if it went anywhere, it was to the Switch based on his personal love or inspiration from the console itself, or from the system's properties. So.
Indeed. Well, Purnell, thank you so much for joining and talking about Yono and
Tofu Kabuto? Yeah, buddy.
Tofu Naruto.
Mmm. Date bio, baby.
That is it for this episode. Purnell, you got any final words to end this son of a bitch?
Someone want to pay my heating bill, because it's time to turn this furnace on.